You meet her, hang out, flirt, no commitment, nobody gets hurt.
She's got brain damage, you psycho.
Okay, I'll give you that one. But I think it'd be healthy for you. You haven't allowed yourself to connect with a girl for many years.
I appreciate your interest, Ula, but leave me alone.
Hey, you'd be doing exactly what her father does, giving her a wonderful day. Then, when it's time for you to go on your big boat trip, poof, you just leave. She'll never even know you're gone.
See, I'm not sure about the poofing part. Like, I'm not a very big poofer. Could you demonstrate a good poof for me?
Quit busting my coconuts for 5 seconds.
All right. Would you stop poofing on that joint and do some work? Hello and welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. I'm your host, Devin Decker, and joining me, a co-curator on this adventure into the Sandlerverse, the cinematic universe of Adam Sandler's films, Sejun Serowik. Sejun?
Hello, Devin. Yes, we are here tonight discussing one of possibly the most beloved of Sandler's films. I mean, the most well received and well respected in past its time. You know, not many of his films have, how's the saying go, aged well. Tonight we're going to see if this one that is so fondly remembered stands up to that, or if it also falls apart.
Certainly its most celebrated film in terms of awards, right? I can't think of another Adam Sandler film that won a prestigious Nickelodeon Kids' Choice Award. But honestly, man, I don't know. If we're here to see if this film aged well, I think I need another drink before we start.
Yeah, man. I am very excited that we're talking about this movie. Like, I want to make sure that we don't start this episode on a down note, because we've fallen into that trap before, and this movie deserves better than that, I will say. This movie has an important place in a lot of different histories, not just like my personal one, but also in the Sandler-verse history, in the Sandler-Barrymore history, in the Sandler post-Sandler history. Like, there's a lot going on in this movie that it like needs to like it, it needs it, we should have done it sooner.
I mean, it's weird to say that, right? That we should have done it sooner, because it's definitely one that you do in the first year of a podcast examining the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. But I feel if you do it too early, you're kind of tying your hands. It's not the way that I felt about The Wedding Singer. Like, The Wedding Singer is one that I felt like should have been included in that initial batch where we sort of wrote up the rules of being an Adam Sandler cinematic universe film. Not so
For
much
sure.
50 First Dates. And again, that's my
I
opinion
don't know.
On this. And
I
that's
don't.
What we're here to
Know.
discuss.
In a lot of ways, I think for all the worst reasons, this fits in more than Wedding Singer does. And we'll talk about it. But there is something to be said though about the ways in which this movie makes a lot of movies that came after it kind of make a lot more sense to me. And specifically one movie in particular that we're going to have to readdress tonight. We are going to have to re-examine for just a second, and it's not going to change my opinion on it, but it is going to be a new lens to look at it, is Just Go With It. The ways in which this movie informed what happened with Just Go With It became so clear to me as I was watching this movie.
Good. I'm glad to hear you say that. It means that we're starting from the same page, even if you might be in the right margin and I might be in the left margin. But before we go into a deeper discussion about 50 First Dates, let's talk about why we're here, what the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast is really about. In 2020, Adam Sandler released a film called Hubie Halloween, and it reignited this excitement and this fervor for Adam Sandler. But more specifically, it started a discussion about whether or not there is a shared cinematic universe between all of his films. And Sejun and I, we do another podcast called The Say Report, and that's a podcast that's about everything. Mm-hmm. And because we do that podcast, we began to be inundated with comments from friends, family, and strangers saying, why aren't you guys addressing the Adam Sandler elephant that's currently in the room and giving us some sort of Adam Sandler cinematic universe roadmap?
Right, right.
And I mean, the first answer to that is, well, it would be more of an atlas, than a roadmap, right? Because we're exploring a universe. But secondly, and more importantly, the say report's about everything. We needed something where we could actually just focus in on the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. And that's the podcast that you're listening to right now. And the most important thing, and the thing that we want to make sure that we address every episode, is this is our own personal portrayal of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. We're not saying this is the definitive one, but we're going to go in, we're going to do the work, and we're going to decide what films do or do not exist within the parameters that we have set out for an Adam Sandler cinematic universe. I think that catches everybody up, right? I think everybody knows what's going on. See, did I miss anything?
No. So anyone that's interested, listen to the first six episodes where we discuss what lays the groundwork for a definitive film to be in it. And then everything since then has been kind of up in the air. And so that's why tonight, part of what we're going to talk about is whether or not this fits the mold or not, right? And I've got some, it's one of those ones, I will put it this way. It's one of those ones that walks in the door like it was invited to the party, but whether or not it gets to stick around is what we're going to talk about, right?
That is a beautiful way to put it, because there are moments in this film that make me go, huh? But then, because of those same moments, I go, And yeah. I'm glad we do it. So right now we are in our second season of this exploration into the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. And the theme for this next set of episodes, the second season, is the Adam Ands. And that's mostly his romantic comedies, but, you know, we get to have fun and call it Adam and Jennifer Aniston. And currently we're smack dab in the middle, the Empire Strikes Back of Adam and Drew Barrymore.
Yeah.
So here we are. We're at 50 First Dates. And before we go any further, Seijin, do you have any facts and figures on this one?
I do, yeah. So there's a lot that's going on with this movie. So we did address The Wedding Singer last time on the show, which was the first one. And I think in a lot of people's minds, like, that's like the definitive one, especially when you talk about Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore movies. We know that there's three. I don't think it's I don't think we're gonna keep Blended a secret. Like, it exists in the world, right?
Wait, are we doing Blended? No, I'm kidding.
Wait, they did what together? but this idea that The Wedding Singer seems to be kind of like the definitive one, right? The two of them were still like hot and young and all of that sort of stuff. Like, there's this risqueness of the 90s where anything could happen that's going on in that movie. All of that, right? This movie is almost 10 years later. We are sitting in 2004, early 2004, Valentine's Day to be specific, where we get this much more formulaic romantic comedy. I say that despite the fact that it has a beautiful hook to it, in that that there is this weird element of her not being able to remember every day. But we'll get more into that as Devin does his thing in a minute. But the other big thing that's really important about this one is it does better than The Wedding Singer. It's the only one out of their three movies to ever hit number one on the charts, and it stays number one. It comes out February 13th, so it's that weekend of Valentine's Day, and it stays number one for pretty much the rest of February. I think it only gets knocked out by Passion of the Christ at the end of that month when that finally comes out. And I mean,
that's a whole other podcast right there.
And it stays in second for a while after that, right? Yeah. That other romantic comedy. But yeah, so it hits number one. It does gangbusters on a $50 million budget. It does $200 million. Yeah, that's the number I've got here. $200 million. That's including worldwide. Domestically, it still does $120 out of that at $200. So, I mean, like, even if we were just looking at America, like, people are salivating over the number that this movie brings in. So, as I said earlier, it kind of starts to... It adds, to use a phrase from Off Mic, fuel to the fire for a lot of what Sandler then goes on to do going forward. Because 2004 is a weird time. Just before this, in terms of the Sandler-verse, in terms of the Sandler movie, I should say, movie history, we've had Big Daddy the year before that. And then before that was, we had Anger Management. Then we had Big Daddy. I'm going backwards, by the way. And then we had Little Nicky, and that's the one that I wanted to get to. And Little Nicky, as we all kind of know, was kind of like the come to Jesus moment, to return to Passion of the Christ for a second. But yeah, that moment when Sandler had to kind of really figure out how he wanted to continue doing what he was doing, because Little Nicky hit like a brick, like it came out and just dropped, right? And so the idea being like, how could he keep making the movies he wanted to be making and still be allowed to, right? Which is something that a lot of people hit in that career. And some may say that that was the moment where he realized he needed to just start just selling out to either audiences or studios, depending on who you talk to. Some people will point out that he figured out the tried and tested formula of you give, I get, where he would do one movie that was clearly for the studio that would rake in $200 million, and then he got to do something like, you know, that he wanted to do on his own, right? That back and forth is definitely something that could be discussed. But what's really, like, really cool about 50 First Dates is it feels like it's the first movie after Little Nicky that feels like him trying something of his own again. You know, like, I mean, you look at something like Big Daddy, where it's like, well, let's put Sandler with a kid, like that, the comedian with a kid, like,
trope
genre,
yeah,
is like, that's what you do when you're trying to save your career, right? And then Anger Management, let's put him with an old guy,
old person, which, yeah,
right, yeah. So like, it, he kind of, right, it's that idea of just like, he's clearly trying to do something that's going to spark interest in people again, and this is that in going back to teaming up with Drew Barrymore, because as I mentioned, everybody loves The Wedding Singer, right? Oh, it's The Wedding Singer part two, except, you know, it's the spiritual successor, the sequel, that sort of thing. And so they get to ride that wave. But one of the most important things that we talked about when we talked about The Wedding Singer is how much chemistry him and Drew Barrymore actually have, and the fact that it is clear that they enjoy working together. And it's not just the two of them, but everyone around them benefits from that. And so there is something really, like, there's something really kind of once in a lifetime chance about this movie, where they get to, it's almost in the bag. Like, you never want to say that about any movie that's being made, and I'm sure some executive out there will use that speak and then go home and curse themselves when stuff like this kind of comes up. But the idea being like, this was kind of like a no-brainer in so many different ways, and so this movie just kind of comes out and kind of does what we all knew it was going to do, some to the point where a lot of critics kind of cite it as being like, yep, it's what you thought it was going to be. Like, and to them, that's a negative. And, you know, but I would like to point out that in the year of 2004, getting a movie that you kind of know what it's going to be and it being a good time, it was kind of needed in that moment.
Yeah, you know? We were definitely ready. I mean, Love Actually comes out the year before. That's a movie that releases the year before, November 2003. And that's the one that kind of reminds us that movies are sort of supposed to make us feel good and warm, and it's not meant to be scary, and we're not, so we're ready for the comfort film again. And so, before we get too far away from it, Siege, I think you made one of the classic blunders, and I call it one of the classic blunders because I myself am guilty of it all the time. Mr. Deeds was 2002, not Big Daddy. I get those two confused all the time.
Okay.
Yeah, that's it. Big Daddy is actually before Little Nicky. I just want to make sure that we're doing the timeline correctly. Because Big Daddy came before Little Nicky. That's one of the reasons why so many people were excited to see something like Little Nicky. And then, what the hell was that? That was the movie that we were expecting from Adam Sandler after his funny movie with a kid. And we'd also be remiss to not mention Punch Drunk Love, which also was a 2002 movie.
And so in that, you then, I mean, if we're going to do this whole thing, he also had Eight Crazy Nights. He also had,
I mean, and 2002 was a big year for him. Right. But going animated is very different from the live action, trying to recapture the magic of The Wedding Singer and that whole universe with something like 50 First Dates.
Sure, but in terms of like a studio looking for a surefire hit from a guy that just dropped his pants on Little Nicky, right?
Yeah.
Like they need something that's a guarantee, and a holiday animated movie with songs in it is like pretty much a safe bet.
Yeah, it's basically, you know the Hanukkah song? It's that, but a movie. Yeah. Take all of our money, Adam. We trust you implicitly.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, Punch Drunk Love, it speaks to your message about doing a film that the studio wants him to do and then getting to do his own thing.
Yeah,
if we look at,
You know, or it's such a, this is the moment though in Sandler's career. The important thing to take away, right, is this is the moment in Sandler's career where nobody's quite sure anymore, including Sandler himself, of what's going on, what is he doing, and am I allowed to talk about it in public anymore?
I mean, we're
Right?
almost 10 years away from when he jumped onto the scene with Billy Madison. So it makes sense, right? Was he a flash in the pan 90s thing, or does he have the staying power to be meaningful in the 2000s, especially considering everything that we've gone through up to this point?
And I think that like the handful of films that he does between 2002, 2003, this is on the back end of that wave where it's still like I need to find that surefire thing, but this is the first time where he feels comfortable enough to kind of push himself a little bit for the first time in his movies. Like it's really, and I don't mean that he's like going to do anything edgy or extreme, quite the opposite. He's finally comfortable, I think, is the big thing I'm trying to get at, right? Like this is the first movie we've seen from him since before Little Nicky where it feels like he's having a good time.
That I will agree with that. That's a very smart thing. And this film is also informed by a lot of the decisions that surrounded something like The Wedding Singer. The fact that it releases Valentine's weekend seems like it's trying to use that same marketing magic that they use with The Wedding Singer to make lightning strike twice.
So just some other stuff, just kind of about the world that I think is really interesting. First of all, one of the pieces of trivia that somebody tried to put on the internet, and I think this is straight from like the PR marketing, like maybe even straight from Sandler's mouth, was, well, we like it's this beautiful movie set in Hawaii because nobody films movies in Hawaii, which is utter bullshit, not least of which because in the same month that this movie came out, you also had Along Came Polly and The Big Bounce, which were two other kind of date night movie-ish, date-ish movies that you would go to, kind of like, I'm not saying that they're all the same movie, but they're all in that same like zone of this is the kind of thing I want to like turn my brain off for an hour and a half. And all three of them are filmed in on location in Hawaii. So it's a really weird, it was a really weird comment to be made about him. And it was like the last one out of the three to come out. But in terms of the actual like romantic comedy date movie, the other thing to keep in mind is what is in the water right now for what people think like that kind of movie is. The only other one besides Along Came Polly that's worth mentioning that comes out around the same time is what's the really weird one with Tad Hamilton, Win a Date with Tad Hamilton,
Oh,
which is like,
gosh.
right? Like, that's the, I think Chasing Liberty maybe came out earlier in January, if you even want to consider that in the same grouping. I think that hits a little bit on the lower, on the age curve, personally.
That's more of a teen
But,
flick. You're not wrong. But
right.
I
Yeah,
mean,
but I think that,
credit
like,
for just name checking Chasing Liberty in terms of just existing as a movie, honestly.
But
And
that's the kind of market that it's kind of entering, right? Is we've either got these really weird Win a Date with Tad Hamilton, which is like playing on the cynicism of like the reality TV that we're all hate watching, Chasing Liberty, which is just doing its best to just be like the poppy, bubbly, fun film so that we all can forget about the world for a minute. Like this movie is entering that realm, right? The fact that it gets to kind of stand out in a lot of ways and do as well as it does is, it says something. I think it also, trying to think if there's any other movie that came out. Not really at this month. No, I'm looking now, and Valentine's Day was, in a weird way. If this came out this year on Valentine's Day, like this coming year, if it was coming out on Valentine's Day and nothing else was up against it, I'd say, oh, everybody's avoiding the Adam Sandler movie. But I don't know if that feeling would have persisted then. You know what I mean?
no, again, I mean the fact that Wedding Singer came out during Valentine's weekend, everybody thought, well, that's a mistake. That's the wrong thing to do because people don't go to the movies for Valentine's Day. The movies were not part of the discussion. And even 9 years later, as, 50 First Dates is coming out, that not 9 years, 7 years, right in around there. There's still that thought and that idea in the water that no, people don't go to the movies for Valentine's Day. It's for other things, right? Like you don't want a
this is
movie because the Oscars still pervade February, right?
right.
Those are the time that people are going to see those movies because the Oscars are coming up at the end of the month. So if you release something new, it's going to be chum in the water for these sharks that have already been proven valuable to the moviegoer.
Oh yeah, just I mean in the top 10, they're the bottom of the top 10, but they are in the top 10 at the same weekend are Return of the King, Mystic River, Monster, Cold Mountain. So like, yeah, like those are the kinds of movies that you're releasing up against hoping that you're going to do at least some money that
Yeah,
weekend.
like it's a crazy scheme. And now we see, right? Now, because of the steps that Adam Sandler took with movies like The Wedding Singer and 50 First Dates, and honestly, I think a lot more of that credit goes to something like 50 First Dates, that having that movie that releases over Valentine's Day is not the death wish that it once was.
Not even just Valentine's Day. We see him then play this game later with things like Memorial Day and stuff like that, when he starts to release things like Grown Ups or even when his company starts to release things like the Paul Blart movies for Thanksgiving and things like that. Like he knows how to own a holiday weekend with that exact movie that you're like, you're gonna go see your family, and then you're gonna be like, I need to get out of the house for 2 hours.
Oh, Adam Sandler's got something? That might be good enough for everybody who wants to get out of the house with me.
Yeah.
Right? It's got
Exactly.
universal appeal, as they say. And we'll actually address it as we get closer to Thanksgiving. Foreshadowing. But yes, so any other things you want to add before I jump into the synopsis of this film?
I don't know if we'll talk about them too much later, so we could talk about now that this is one of the few movies that he makes with Peter Segal, including Anger Management before this movie, and then the only other one is I believe the movie right after this, which is what is that one
Longest
written out?
Yard. Yeah,
Longest
it's
Yard.
weird.
Thank
He
you. I
does
want to make
this
sure I get
whole
that
three
right.
thing. He does 2003 Anger Management, 2004 50 First Dates, and then 2005 The Longest Yard. And that's very strange that there's this trilogy of Peter Siegel films just like
Yeah, and I
smashed
mean,
into his filmography.
and like Peter Siegel, somebody that we still see going strong. He was the one that just had My Spy last year
That's
that
correct.
that Devin raved about and stuff. And there's a couple of other really good ones on there. But they, you know, it fits in with Siegel's like work. It doesn't feel like it's an odd one for him. Clearly, Sandler liked working with the guy enough that apparently the day that they were done editing Anger Management, he said to him like, "Hey, me and Barrymore are making this movie. We'd like you to be involved." And like he just so I believe the timing on it was literally he said Siegel has said that it was not like 2 days after he finished post-production on Anger Management that he began production work on this. So it was like it didn't even stop for them. And then the writer on this is also a really interesting one to point out simply because he only ever really wrote this and one other thing. So George Wing, do you recognize the name, Dev?
Not right off the top of my head.
The
It's.
only other thing he ever did was the movie and television show of Outsourced.
Oh, okay.
He's also credited as the story writer on every version of this movie that came out because this movie led to a bunch of different foreign remakes. I believe there's a really famous Korean one, there's a really famous Indian one, and he is credited as the story writer on all of those because it is his story. But this was like so what that says is this was kind of that tiny that old Hollywood story of the writer that has that one script that they know that this is their story that they need to get out into the world and they can't get it made, they can't get it made, and then some guy comes along and is like, I'll make your movie, except I'm gonna rewrite it 6 times and it's not gonna be the movie you wrote in the end, right? But from what I get, it's not entirely that. And we'll talk a little bit more about that because it ties a lot into what are my feelings about how this kind of reflects on what happens with Just Go With It. But it was a story that this one person, this George Wing, had written, was apparently much more, I don't want to say much more dramatic, but not as Adam Sandler-y, shall we say, as it became, obviously, after Sandler and Colbert got a hold of the script. And I think that anybody that's ever seen either the movie or the TV show of Outsourced, both phenomenal, by the way, like just really good, like romantic comedy fun times that are worth watching, can kind of get the idea of where this movie probably would have landed a lot more in the of the 2000s, that like that dramatic comedy that we love so much, the like the Junos, right? The that we held up and gave awards to. So we would have seen a little bit less of the vomiting walrus, right? And a little bit more maybe of those moments of like Drew Barrymore like coming to terms with the fact that she's remembering life again, that sort of stuff. So it's just it's a really interesting thing to kind of parse out how much of this movie is Sandler, because we're once again dealing with a movie that was not entirely created by him and his crew, but instead they kind of thrust themselves upon this story. But yeah, we'll talk more
And
about that more,
that
I think, after.
preamble is perfect for things that I have planned to discuss later on in this episode. Both of those things that you were like, I don't know if we're going to get to it. Osija, baby. We were going to get to them. And I'm happy. I'm oh so happy in this moment. And that's why we're skipping the first impressions. Also, because Seijin doesn't want to start on a downer, and he's right. We should probably pep this one up, right? I'm already feeling alive and full of energy. And my first impressions of this film, 17 years later, it wouldn't have done that. I can just tell you that right now. Probably wouldn't have done that. But without any further ado, let's jump to the synopsis so then we can get back to George Wing and Peter Siegel. Henry Roth is an aquatic veterinarian living in Hawaii with serious commitment issues. While some people say there's a woman to blame, I think the real reason he doesn't want to get tied down is knowing that one day he will set sail for Alaska to research walruses. Unfortunately, on November 5th, 2003, his vessel, the Sea Serpent, proves less than ready for the 2,528-mile journey from Oahu to Bristol Bay, and he wound up at the Hukilau Cafe, where a local girl caught his eye. Unable to stop thinking about her, Henry returns the next day, hoping she'll be there again so he can introduce himself. Fortune favors Henry, and he meets Lucy Whitmore, who is having breakfast there just like she does every morning, and the two make an instant connection. After spending the morning together at the restaurant, they make plans to meet the next day and do it again. Despite his objections to falling for a local and a vow never to go back to the diner, Henry arrives early the next day. However, when Lucy arrives, she doesn't recognize him as anything more than a stranger. The owner of the Hukilau, Sue, takes Henry aside and explains that due to a head injury sustained on October 13, 2002, Lucy has no short-term memory and wakes up every morning believing that it's once again the 13th of October, and that her father Marlin and brother Doug do their best to ensure that Lucy does the same thing every day. Despite this complication, Henry decides to pursue something resembling a normal relationship with Lucy. When Marlin finds out about Henry's continued attempts at pitching woo with his brain-damaged daughter, he makes Henry promise to stay away from the Hukilau. Unable to walk away from the one who has captured his heart, Henry decides to improvise and arranges different ways to interact with Lucy on her drive home each day. Eventually, Marlin realizes that on the days when Henry has met with his daughter, she sings, and after a discussion about it with him, decides that Henry's intentions are pure. After a bad day when the facade is broken, Henry questions if it might be better to start each morning showing her a video explaining the accident and what has happened in the interim, hoping that it can allow her to get back to life and actually living. But when Lucy realizes she may be keeping Henry from living his own fulfilling life, she breaks up with him and declares her intent to erase him completely from her journal, so it's as if he never existed. Once again unfettered, Henry leaves for Alaska, but after hearing their song, decides to see Lucy one last time. Lucy confesses that even though she doesn't know him, she sees him every night in her dreams, and Henry admits the only way his life will be fulfilled is with her as part of it, and the two begin their future together.
Yeah, okay, so one, you clarified something for me that I think the movie did not make clear. There's a lot that this movie does not make clear.
Yeah.
But the number one thing that I think is important that I was kind of confused on is the Beach Boys memory thing. So the idea is she sings, she like her family finds her happy, joyous, and singing on the days after she has been spending the day with Henry?
Yeah, so if Henry intercepts her on the way home from the Hukilau Cafe, you know, with his little, sorry, ma'am, the road is closed, or I need a jump on my car, when she gets home and she does her usual daily activity of repainting the workshop garage area that her father and brother paint white every night. And again, mm-hmm. these are the things that I can't focus on right now because I want to be in that happy, good mood. She will sing the Beach Boys' Wouldn't It Be Nice? And yeah, that is actually the song that her father and mother had as their, like, love song, and the song that, like, mattered and defined their relationship. So the fact that any day that she sees him, that's the song that triggers in her. I mean, this movie is a bunch of pseudoscience, and I don't even touch on that stuff because it's going to be a big part of New Old Borrowed Blue. I think I'm pretty sure that that's going to come up.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting because the way that the science is talked about is a lot of places talk about the idea that this was a thing that didn't exist before this movie. However, since this movie has come out, there's been a couple of different things that have been really interesting. First and for like the very first time that a case in real life appeared like this, they found out that the woman was a huge, I believe, Sandler fan, maybe Drew Barrymore fan, but swore up and down she'd never seen this movie. So the doctors had a really hard time trying to figure out if she had just kind of ghosted this into her perception of what had been happening to her or not. And they didn't. And I, there, you know, I'm not going to sit here and act like I like read like medical journals to draw conclusions. But that is, you know, that is the story.
Yeah.
Whether or not they kind of determine anything there. The more interesting thing is that this movie has led to a lot of different organizations and places that deal with people that have memory loss and Alzheimer's and things like that, actually using techniques from within the movie to actually help with their patients. And so, like, weirdly, it's credited in a few different homes, facilities, I don't know the proper term here, but throughout the country, as actually inspiring the facility staff to actually try some of the techniques within the movie, and it actually being stuff that they still do to this day. So, like, it's weird because it is totally based on nonsense, and there's no like medical science that they even try and throw at you really too much in this. They mention a couple of moments about the frontal lobe being where memory is, and like, yes, but like I said, they don't use a bunch of terminology that's made up except for just the name of the disease.
Yeah.
But the bigger thing is what's really weird, what's really cool, I guess I should say after that, is that it does lead to a bunch of people that work in this field to actually like take a little from this. So like it's a weird give and take that this movie does when it comes to the science. It's not as gross as some movies out there that deal with weird diseases. I'll give it that.
Yeah, that's high praise to give to it too, because you're right. It could have just been like basic amnesia that we see as a trope in all forms of entertainment, which,
or anything to deal with the brain, right?
Yeah.
All I could think of the entire time I was watching this movie was that awesomely terrible movie with Scarlett Johansson, Lucy. If anybody's never seen that movie, do yourself a favor. Spend $2 on like Google Play and rent the shit out of that one night and just have some fun, because that movie is freaking buck wild. But the ways in which that plays with the idea that you only use 10% of your brain, but if you used 100%, you could take over the world is ridiculous. And they do go deep into some like bullshit science to the point where it gets dangerous, because in a world where people read Facebook and they think that that's a scientific study, that movie can do some damage. And I don't think this ever gets to that level.
Yeah, I certainly agree. And even then, like, there's two prominent cases. You mentioned the one where the woman does swear up and down, and then there's another one that's very similar to it. But in both of those cases, they're similar to what is on display in Drew Barrymore's Lucy character. It is not the exact same thing where the mind has issue transposing short-term memory into long-term memory. And actually, one of the coolest things about everything related to this film, because the term short-term and long-term memory are used extensively, is that in the 17 years since this film released in 2004, we've actually discovered a third intermediate memory, which would kind of throw the entire thing that's happening in this film completely out the window in terms of how our minds work and the damage that's done to Lucy and how she processes things, which is actually really interesting, because it would also feed into why her subconscious could dream up Henry every night is actually because of what we know now about the intermediate memory.
Yeah. So, you know, there's the other thing this makes me think of is, and it's much better handled in, of all things, Office Space, where the idea being that what happens to the character in that movie is he is put under hypnosis, and then in the middle of that, the hypnotist dies, or I think he is actually at a doctor. The doctor just for some reason performs hypnotism on him, and the doctor dies in the middle of it, so he's never brought out of that hypnosis. So for the rest of the movie, you are left kind of with the understanding that the reason his entire attitude has changed is because he is still under this, for lack of a better term, spell, right?
Yeah.
But what that movie does really well is that is the kind of the setup, the exposition given to you in the first 10 minutes of that movie, and then it's never addressed again. That is just what happens, and then it's done. There's never a moment where anybody's just like, we need to get him to another doctor. We need to get a second opinion. We need to get the, they don't talk about it anymore. And so I feel like if this movie had kind of taken that route of just explaining she got into a car accident, now she doesn't have memory, the end. Like if they had just said that once in the beginning, and then, like, I'm not saying ignore the car accident for the rest of the story. I don't think you can do that, but you can at least say, like, it affected your memory, blah. don't go into it. Don't bring doctors into it. Don't bring any of that into it. It would probably have saved a lot of grief that it probably is now getting at this moment.
Yeah. I mean, there's some good stuff, though, at the Callahan Institute
I'm excited to discuss. I love. Yeah, no. But that's the other side of it, right? Yeah. Also, there's that idea that there's also a little bit of just, like, sometimes we just have to accept movie magic, right? And the problem becomes when that movie magic is, like, kind of, like, poking fun at or exploiting, shall we say, people with actual conditions, right? And it's really interesting to me that it feels weird, it feels gross, because this is a medical thing that they are kind of, like, joking about throughout this entire movie, and it is plot significant. But at the same time, the reaction to it, as far as I can tell, was never one of, like, you hear about it sometimes. There was no group out there defending Alzheimer's patients being like, this movie makes fun of us. Meanwhile, like, around that exact same time, you have movies like The Ringer that get called out by important groups for the shit that they do, right? It's just it is an interesting thing that this movie, for lack of a better term, seems to get away with.
Yeah. I like that. I like the way that you put that. But I think one of the ways they do it is because they do use such junk science that there's never that moment where you'd be like, oh my God, that's just like this real world thing that people are suffering from. They're able to divorce themselves from reality in the science behind what is affecting Lucy, that you're never taken out of the world and brought into the real world and the connotations of what is going on.
I mean, it is true magic, and as something that we've discussed in other Sandler films, and specifically in Sandlerverse films, like that idea of the presence of just something magic, and sometimes that just means that things just happen that you just kind of have to accept are okay that it happened because, like, magic.
Yep, magic is real in the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. And what does that mean related to a film like 50 First Dates? We'll get there. I promise you, folks, we will get there. But yeah, but I guess the reason why I say that the science is kind of janky and not perfect in this film is the fact that she retains anything, because even the doctor, who is played by Dan Aykroyd, I don't want to blow up his spot, right? But Dan Aykroyd plays the doctor in this film.
I don't think he's ashamed that he's in this movie.
Right. I don't want to take anything away from what might happen in the rest of the show. He is adamant that there is no way that this will ever be cured for her. So that, so a lot of his scenes, in a weird way, he acts as Mr. Logic, and he comes in to swing his logic hammer and say, I know you want to believe that she's getting better and that she is starting to remember you, but that's simply not the case. And I'm sorry to be the one to say that to you. So then, like, that weird connective moment where, like, I realize that on days when you see her, she sings, and then that being weirdly plot significant to, like, oh my God, she does remember me. I mean, she could just be singing because she met a guy that she liked, right? And it doesn't necessarily have to be Henry Roth that she met, but just somebody that excited her. It's junk science in the resolution of this film, so we say. But we can save that more for the discussion part of this film, or of this episode discussing this film, because I'm fit to burst related to our old classic, something new, something old, something borrowed, something blue. So I'd really like to jump to it.
Let's do it. Let's do it, man.
All right. So the only thing I know is I want to go second on borrowed, because there ain't no way you're stumbling into my borrowed manure. If you say what I have written down, I'll buy you a Cadillac, and that's a binding promise.
I have a throwaway borrowed, but then I also have, like, a real borrowed, and I'm wondering if I got it and if it's my throwaway.
Well, if it's your throwaway, no Cadillac, because I think it's substantial. But let's start with something new. And I'll let you go first on that one. You can go first on everything. This is your week for firsts. Your week, man. Your month. This is the monthly podcast.
I had a new down, and then something just before the show hit me like lightning. And it is that this is the first time. So I trashed my old new, and I have a new, and my new is, I cannot believe I didn't register this at the moment. This is the first time Kevin James shows up.
Nice. Very nice.
Kevin James shows up as just a fleeting moment as a joke in the beginning of this movie. A joke that has some connotations that go way too deep for anything I want
to
talk about.
A juicy contradiction of a joke as well related to other things that occur in the film.
Yeah. Yeah. But we see Kevin James show up for just a moment in the opening montage of people that have been how shall I put this, affected by Henry.
Good. Yeah, don't say coned. That one would get that, but people who work for cruise lines. And I had to slip it in there just in case any of you are listening. Hi, Dream Family.
But he's credited as just simply factory worker, and this is the first time that he shows up in any Sandler project. And so going forward is when we start to see him. I think almost like 3 years later is Chuck and Larry. 4 years later,
Chuck and Larry is 2007. So yeah,
so three years later. So there you go.
So yeah, it was nice to see him. And though we have covered movies that he appears in before on the show, this is the first time that he breaches the veil into a potential Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
This is the first appearance of Kevin James, and should not go unnoticed. That should not go unnoted. I mean,
and that is exciting. And to go with that, it's not my new, but to go along with that. Dan Aykroyd, this is the first time that it feels like Dan Aykroyd is coming to the party for it being an Adam Sandler cinematic universe film.
Yeah, it's certainly not the first one that he has made kind of in this homeboy group. I mean, we talked about the Callahan Institute earlier and the reference to Sandusky, Ohio, a straight up, this is giving a little bit of some of my stuff later on away, but straight up giving a connection to Tommy Boy, right? And it's beautiful in that. But the idea being that this is the first time Sandler puts him on screen. And then, as I mentioned, Chuck and Larry, he becomes a huge role in that a few years later.
But one of the reasons why that kept that from being my official new is they work together on Coneheads, right?
Yes.
So it's not completely outside the realm that Dan Aykroyd and like Adam Sandler has his number, or that Dan Aykroyd would take a phone call from him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But also, I think that we need to discuss the Peter Siegel of it all, but I'm sure we'll get there based on the little thing you gave. So my new is going to be destination filmmaking. This is the first time that this is a vacation job for them.
Slut was my other new. Straight from Devin Decker's mouth. I forgot that he's a vacation slut in this movie. Yeah, I know that you meant the idea that everybody slept with them while they were on vacation.
No, but it also works both ways. It was... Yes. Yeah, this is where we meet vacation slut Adam Sandler, and we have to begin hearing every time a new Adam Sandler film comes out, whether it is fun Adam Sandler broing down or the serious, like, dramatic film that he's just doing it so he can travel with his people. Because Spanglish, that's a discussion that comes up. And I'm like, did you see Spanglish? Because that's a weird critique of that movie.
No, more importantly, in this particular conversation, the very next movie that he makes with Barrymore, right? The end of the trifecta for them so far is Blended, which is them going to Africa. Yeah. And I mean, like, that famously was just something that the two of them just were like, we are besties. I think they call each other on-screen soulmates, like literally both use that term about each other. And they're just like, let's go to Africa and make a movie.
Yeah, let's not dip too much into our well of Blended trivia, but you're not wrong. That is exactly what Blended exists for. And if this film never came along, I don't think that film would have ever, well, gone to Africa, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
So what do you got for old Seijin? Tell old Devi boy.
So I think as far as the old goes for this that we've seen before, but I think it's important to note here is Schneider. We've got Rob Schneider, and the reason why it's important to kind of bring him up again, because we have seen him before, is this is the first time in the timeline where he is. I mean, he's third billed on IMDb for this movie with Sandler and Barrymore. It's a, this is a Sandler, Barrymore, and Schneider project. And the thing is like before this, we had seen him as the townie in The Water Boy. He had shown up as the delivery guy, but he doesn't even get a name in Big Daddy. He's just the delivery guy and has like two scenes with him. But in this, he is named. We are given like history on his backstory, and he is like a best friend that oversees their wedding at the end of the film. Like he is buddy buddy, and we don't get to see it too often going forward because there's a couple of other movies where he does show up, definitely in the grouping and in Grown Ups. But like, I'm like not gonna speak out of turn here. I don't know what's going on in terms of him not showing him as much stuff anymore. But he's not there for everything anymore. You know, he's really taken a back seat in the last like 10 years when it comes to the Sandler movies. And famously not in Grown Ups 2, I believe, if
Right,
I'm
that is
remembering correctly.
correct. But also, I mean, big shout out, and I think one of the things that started the fervor around Hubie Halloween is him coming back for that and having that role
Yes,
there.
but
So,
notably not in any single scene with Sandler.
yeah.
Just pointing out, like,
That's an
literally not a
inter.
single scene with Sandler.
So yeah, there is that. Rob Schneider's not bad. And I did like to see him actually getting a meatier role. And that is specifically what the role of Ula is. Is it a perfect role? I'm gonna say no on that one. But yeah, so for my old, it's the soundtrack from The Wedding Singer. And I know that might sound like a huge effing cop out, but
No.
you don't get over the fact that Hold Me Now by the Thompson Twins and the True Remix by Spandau Ballet, and there's a third song. Oh, I Melt With You, the fact that there's a Rick Ocasek Cars song, like so
This isn't
many
a
of
Dev, this isn't a cop out. This is one of the best pieces of trivia about this movie, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. So many of the songs that show up and are meaningful in The Wedding Singer have covers performed in this film to make it all remind you that The Wedding Singer exists and subconsciously dump dopamine into your brain to make you think you're enjoying this film more.
You know, I joked before about the idea that somebody had the balls to say that this was one of the few movies ever filmed actually in Hawaii. But what I will give it credit for is there was that weird kind of resurgence in the 2000s, in the mid 2000s and later, of that like that love of the Hawaiian version, the reggae style classic, the ukulele cover, that all of these different types of music that kind of come out of that area. Like, and there was this love of that kind of blew up. And I think a lot of that love came from a movie like this, where you get that kind of soundtrack where they cover a bunch of those songs that we loved before. You know, it's like in the 90s when everybody started to fall in love with Big Band Swing, all because The Mask like blew that shit up, right? Like you can say that it was The Mask's fault, or you can argue that it wasn't, but either way you have to at least give it credit for being part of that trend. And I think that's the same thing here, is like I can't tell you that this movie made everybody fall in love with that style of music, but for some reason we all fell in love with that style of music, and this movie capitalized on that in some fashion. And I think that I think it's really kind of emblematic of the time in which it's made. But also, again, this goes back to the idea that they just lucked out every second, every step of the way on this movie. They knew exactly how lucky they were. They were just like, let's just, everybody loves doing ukulele covers of old music. Let's just take all of this stuff from The Wedding Singer and do ukulele covers of it and make it the soundtrack of this movie. Like, hell yeah.
Yeah, it's insane. It's literally insane to the fact where I'm like, oh, I know that song. It was in The Wedding Singer, and then like, oh my God, it just happens. So I'm gonna do something I never do, something that I'm a staunch believer of never doing.
Are you meant to play ukulele in the quad? What are we doing?
No, God, no, no.
Okay.
That's not even something that you can say out loud, right? That's just a fact that ain't ever gonna happen. I'm gonna admit a weakness of myself. And the reason why I'm going to admit that weakness is because I need you. I need your help. And the weakness is the fact that I do not know 311 as well as I should. It is a
Okay.
huge blind spot in like my musical knowledge is the band 311. And I don't know why that's the case, but it's just the case. Is this the movie that like associated 311 with Hawaii? Or was that always their style of music? Because you see a lot of 311 being used in, like, The Descendants is one that jumped to mind in terms of...
Do you know the other big song that kind of came out around the same time as Amber for them?
No, I told you. It's my one of my weaknesses is the band 311.
So the song is Down. If you heard it, or Come Original is another one from them. So, like, Amber is the Color of Your Energy is on the mellower side for their music, but it's definitely the genre that they've always been in. Okay. Like, that is the genre that they live in, but I would say that there was a little bit more of the upbeat California. Think of, like, the funny Offspring songs. That is probably just a little bit more energetic than the more upbeat 311 songs. But even then, they could be on the same CD. You know what I mean?
I got that,
Yeah, but specifically the funny stuff. I love the Offspring, but there are two Offsprings, and you got to be very specific which Offsprings you're talking about.
I know, I've actually made that mistake a lot of times, because I liked that one that, you got not Keep Them Separated, that the one with the
Piper, white guy?
The statue head is breaking on it.
Yes. That, yeah, like, so Splinter, the album
Splinter. Yeah. Which, like, legitimately would splinter that fan base. And I've not known that, like that was the first full album I got. I got gifted it while I was working at the radio station.
Yeah, with Hit That on it, I believe, right?
Yeah, like, Hit That is the song I couldn't think of the name of. And that feels like it's the funny version. And then I listened to the rest of that album, and I'm like, oh my God, these guys are, like, I didn't realize that they did this. And then with a group of people talking about the funny Offspring, I brought up a not-so-funny Offspring song off of Splinter. And those looks are looks that are burned into my brain.
Fuck those people. They never listen to Smash. Anyway, we listen to my Offspring podcast that I have. But as far as 311, right, and that Amber is the Color of Energy is it's probably one of those songs that when a band gets really famous, people try and listen to the rest of their music, and they're like, this isn't anything like that, like Amber. But I think it does actually fit in pretty well with the rest of their music if you're into that kind of like what's the right term for it? It's not reggaetonic, but it's like electronica, like ska. Like it's really a weird genre that could have only existed in the 2000s when we were all trying to figure our shit out.
Yeah.
You know, and Smash Mouth got kind of into that realm for a little bit. Like, there's a lot of bands that dip their toes into that genre because they were just trying to figure out what the hell they were doing after 9/11.
Yeah, it's one of those situations because I'm looking so deeply into all of these songs that are on both Wedding Singer and 51st Dates and, like, noticing it. And then, like, every third song is a song from 311. And that's, I'm like, oh, okay. That's, I didn't realize that it wasn't just Amber that they did that appeared in this. And yeah. I'm like, so that's cool. And I can totally get behind that. And then, like, I think about something like The Descendants, which, you know, just like electrified audiences for some reason. I mean, I like George Clooney, don't get me wrong. And this is more of a Say Report discussion, definitely. But they used a lot of 311 in that as well. And it made me wonder, oh, is this because of 51st Dates? Or is it just the fact that this is that genre?
Yeah, well, two crazy things that you need to know about 311, really, honestly, and thinking about them being on this soundtrack and The Descendants, both films filmed in Hawaii. But 311 is a band from 1988. Like, that's one of the first things that a lot of people don't really know, but hence their presence on the Wedding Singer soundtrack, right? But the other thing
No, they're not on the Wedding Singer. The reason why I notice it is that they're the outlier in terms of recreated songs. Yeah, most of the new stuff is 311.
But then to that point, the idea why they fit in with a lot of the stuff from The Wedding Singer is that they were there, too. They just weren't that realm, right? But then the other side of that is for all of this talk about them being this, like, super chill West Coast band and all of this stuff, they're from fucking Omaha. So, like that's the other thing to remember is that they were trying to capture that, like, West Coast feel that, again, a lot of guys like The Offspring and stuff like that were bringing to the table. That, like, California punk, but then what they were doing is they were throwing a little bit of that, like, Islander, like feel on top of it. For take that for whatever you want to take that, but, like, that was their concept, and they basically rode that wave for decades after that.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. So thank you, because that did it. And I guess the last thing, just because we're talking about soundtracks in this moment, is this movie right here, 50 First Dates, is why Just Go With It has an all police soundtrack. Because of that Hawaiian version of Every Breath You Take that starts the credits of this film. Yeah. Yeah, it's like, it's such a roll from one into the other that it actually affects how I feel about this film and its standing in the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. That there's words that I have put out there.
Yeah.
And I can't wait till we get to that part of the episode. But all now, right. Borrowed, Sijin. What'd you borrow?
Okay, so first of all, if you're about to talk about From Here to Eternity, is that your big secret?
No! What am I, a fucking putz? Just because I love old Blue Eyes doesn't mean that, like, I hung my hat on From Here to Eternity.
Just because, like, I have talked about this before, but the ways in which Sandler and his crew really do kind of dip into the, like, the tribute to old Hollywood from time to time, and it's not always clear. It was not clear to me at first in this movie until I started to kind of recognize something about the particular scene, and I realized that I'd seen that beach before, but I swore it was going to be something stupid, like Blue Crush or some nonsense. But no, apparently it is. It's because that's the same beach from the moment where they're in the caves and stuff like that.
The iconic sequence from Here to Eternity, where when I brought my mother to see that in the movie theater, she's like, I had no idea that this is what that movie about. I thought it was just people fucking on a beach. And I'm like, nobody's surprised that you just said that, Mom.
But my true borrowed, though, and this kind of hints, this kind of goes back to something I hinted at earlier, is the reference to Tommy Boy. And it's not the only reference that we really see. We see a Happy Gilmore reference in this movie, in which when the kids do the Happy Gilmore stance and knock it out of the park, literally. And then there's also there's something to be said about how this movie is very reminiscent of the Dana Carvey movie, Clean Slate. This is the first time in Sandler movies that we really get to see him start to reference movies that he actually was a part of or his friends were a part of. Like, for all of the old Hollywood stuff he consistently referenced for the first 10 years of his career, this is now the point where they've all been making movies for so long and all of them have such prolific, like, film backgrounds, like, filmmaking backgrounds, that he can start referencing literally either his own movies or his friends' movies or, like, pay tribute to Chris Farley, who passed away years earlier by having the Callahan name brought up in this movie. Like, there's all these little tiny moments of referencing his own film history. And I thought that was a really cool thing that he starts to borrow from.
So I will say the fact that Happy Gilmore lands in borrowed for you and not in old is very telling. And I just need to say that. I need to say it because it makes sense. It makes so much sense.
Well, because it's not like an oeuvre or an idea that he brought forward.
Yeah.
It is a literal reference to that moment.
I know.
Right?
And that is, and that, then there we go. And there we go with why it's going to be important. It's not my borrowed. You didn't touch on my borrowed. I'm not hyper surprised you didn't touch on my borrowed. But while we're talking about old Hollywood, we should also talk some new Hollywood stuff that's featured here. And going backwards, since you already mentioned it, Blue Crush. Where they live in Blue Crush is the cafe. It's the cafe. Oh. It's the same beach and the same location. So
awesome.
Happy that you brought up Blue Crush. Where the Hukilau Cafe is located is the same area where they shot a bunch of Jurassic Park. If we're also going to talk about, like, new Hollywood and things that took place and filming in Hawaii, which is fun. And then my last and favorite borrowed, and it's kind of borrowed adjacent, is the fact that the Sea Serpent, his sailboat, is the sister ship of the sailboat that features in Captain Ron.
That's awesome. That's a phenomenal, like, one-off. That fits in with what I'm saying, though, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Because, like, it's pointing to those kinds of movies that they all kind of, man. Yeah, and I think that what's really interesting about this is that this is where you kind of start to see the idea being that this idea of a shared universe that oh my God, Sandler's connected all of his movies is it kind of falls apart on a super meta level when you start to think about the fact that, as we have pointed out since episode one of this show, is he connects all these.
He connects so much. Yeah.
Right, like he just he's a guy that loves to put a clue there for you. And that is, and it's just fun. And like, it's not plot important. You're not supposed to like the fact that the O'Doyles are here does not make you realize something about the story that you never realized before. Like, that's not the point. It's just, it's there for you because he's making, it's there for him. It's there for anybody that gets it. And if you don't get it, it's okay. It's not going to affect your viewing of the film. And like, and so this idea that we're exploring, like the whole point of the show, that it's all connected, is on some level majorly flawed because Sandler just likes to do that. And so, of course, at some point, it's going to be a little bit more obvious than not, right?
Yes. Very much yes. Which brings me to my borrowed. Okay. And I'm happy you brought up George Wing and saying that George Wing had a story to tell. Because I disagree with that. Because my borrowed is The Notebook by Nicholas Sparks. Specifically the novel. Because it really feels like George Wing read that novel, and you need to understand, this is before Nicholas Sparks was like a big name in Hollywood adaptations. Yeah. The Notebook does not come out until fall of 2004. All right? And there are scenes in this movie that feel so ripped from The Notebook that knowing that The Notebook doesn't come out until 6-7 months later means that if they were ripping them from anywhere, it would be 50 First Dates. And they're not, right? If anything, they're like kind of movie twins. But it's hard to ignore the fact that the novelization, The Notebook, had existed for a while. And the idea that somebody could read that book and then be inspired to write something similar to that, but with a twist, is not outside the realm of possibilities. Yeah. And I think that it all boils down to that moment where she shows Henry her journal and she's like, I really like the video. I love the video, but it feels like I'm being told it by somebody else. And this journal allows me to tell myself. So really that seems like this guy read The Notebook and was like, well, I mean, it's great that he's telling her the story of how they fell in love with each other, but wouldn't it be something if it was her own like portrayal of that story of how they fell in love?
Yeah.
So Noah isn't some heroic figure in The Notebook. He's kind of an egg-shaped schlub who wants to study the second largest mammal's penis in the world.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, and it goes even further than that if you know the original kind of stuff that's going on in the script, in that it originally took place in Seattle.
Yep.
It originally took place mostly in diners, which is why you end up with so many restaurant scenes. And literally, like Sandler and Covert talked about in their particular rewrite of it, they wanted to pull as much stuff to the outside as possible. And then that was why it got moved to a place like Hawaii, where they were like, well, and like, let's get this out of like restaurants. I think the exact term was, this feels like my dinner with Andre, and we don't want that, right? Like that idea. So they're just like, let's get this out of restaurants, and then let's go somewhere more interesting to look at than dreary old Seattle. And that's when you end up with Hawaii. So that idea that this is not as original as I may have intended to, like, I didn't mean to say that this was an original story he wanted to tell. I was just saying this was a story he wanted to tell.
Right, exactly. No, but that's the thing, is that the story to tell, when you hear that, it almost sort of feels like it's some story near and dear to the heart, but it really does feel, especially when you consider the fact that, I mean, the original title of this, right, when this was just a script, was 50 First Kisses, and that totally plays into the there's nothing quite like a first kiss montage that almost stalls out this movie that is a tight 90, if I'm being completely honest and jumping the gun on the discussion part of it. Yeah. So imagine if the whole movie were that first kiss montage. I think that you can see like a kind of a glimpse of what the original script was like. And then also the fact that it's set in Seattle and primarily in diners feels very informed by something like Sleepless in Seattle, where, first of all, Seattle became sort of this city to set your romantic story in, right? Mm-hmm. And if you're trying to ignore any comparisons to something like The Notebook, you got to go as far away from the South as possible. And the Pacific yes. Northwest is a perfect place to set a movie or any script that is inspired by this book about Gothic Southern love.
Well, and then there's also the idea of the one that I come to when I think of a bunch of love scenes in diners and restaurants is I also think of When Harry Met Sally, right?
Yep.
Like, just kind of in that same vein. Like I'll have what she's having that moment. Like what if we rewrote that, took it outside, and made it between this older woman and Sean Astin? There's a lot in the core of this story that is just, and this goes to what I said when we first started, that is just so formulaic and tropey.
Yeah.
And so, like, honestly, there's this question then when you start to kind of think about what this movie was before Sandler got a hold of it, and then now the movie that it is, and we know that outcome was a successful one. People love it. People talk about it still. Here we are doing a podcast episode about it, blah, 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 right? Would it have had the same punch if it had not been Sandler and his crew making it? If it had been some other pair, if it had stayed truer to its dramatic roots? And maybe it wouldn't have stayed in Seattle, but maybe it also wouldn't have gone to Hawaii. I mean, what if it got moved to, I don't know, like freaking Alaska, and they all lived out in the middle of nowhere or something? Or, like, you know, they
or it
went
goes
deeper
to
into
New
the woods.
York, right? Like, or it hits New York, or it goes to Texas, or it goes to that Southern Gothic area, right? Because
right.
They hear that The Notebook is going to be adapted, and this film is kind of similar to The Notebook, guys.
So let's get in first.
So let's see if we can do that first. Imagine if this is Nora Ephron and Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's a completely different story. One that I think could exist, right? And due to the nature of possibilities and probabilities, does somewhere in the multiverse. And it's just insane. But really, as somebody who was given a copy of The Notebook as a joke at a Secret Santa the first year I worked at Blockbuster, so 2002, and then I read that book, and then I see this movie, I see a lot of similarities to The Notebook. The kiss in the rain, which becomes so iconic in the film later in this same year.
I mean, to the point where it becomes the cover of the book for the rest of time.
Yeah.
Not just the cover of the movie, but the cover of the book for the rest of time is now the two of them making out in the rain. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm so happy I have that old hardcover book that was given to me kind of as a gag gift. And then I'm like, fuck you. I'm going to show you. I'm going to read this book and be like, oh, this was really sad. And, like, beautiful and heartwarming.
Yeah, right. And, like, and so I don't know if this is to your point or against it, but, like, it allows for some stuff in this movie that really does, in the time when you see it, to be something special, because that kiss in the rain hadn't happened yet, right? We didn't get to see, like, I was about to say Ryan Reynolds.
That's not who's in The Notebook.
No,
it's Gosling.
You can see Ryan McAdams. Ryan Gosling and Rachel McAdams make out in the rain yet, right? So their moment in the rain here is you know, refreshing. Like, I'm not gonna say it's the first time we've ever seen two people kiss in the rain in a movie, but it is. It works really well in this moment. And I say that moment in particular because it also has probably one of those like dream lines as a writer that you're writing down and as an actor that you're reading, that it is tropey as hell. And if it's not read correctly, it's going to be cringy as hell, but it's in the mouth of Drew Barrymore. So you know that it's good. It's perfect. And it is, can I get one last first kiss? And that line is just like, I think of the moment in WandaVision that everybody refers to as like, what is grief but love persisting? Yeah. And like and the meme being like writers everywhere just slapping their head being like, why didn't I think of that? Like, right? Like, it is that kind of line. Like, can I get one last first kiss before you go? Is just like, like heartbreaking and beautifully written and in its simplicity. Like, it is also the simplest line of dialogue to sum up the moment, but at the same time, that can be a good thing, right? And so you get moments like that in this movie that are just wonderful because of the idea that it is kind of just improving on a formula in a lot of ways. And what this movie gets to do is it gets to improve on one particular formula 50 times.
Yeah, it is. I mean, this is kind of a crash course in romantic comedies, mm-hmm. if you really want to boil it down. And I think the other important and kind of cool thing is that this film exists in that Adam Sandler bubble, so that even if you're somebody who with your date went to see 50 First Dates on Valentine's Day, when you go to see The Notebook, that kiss between Gosling and McAdams in the rain is still revolutionary, even though it's almost a variation of something that happened in a film you saw that same year.
Yeah.
And maybe it's that same, like, dopamine from that moment bleaching into this one and making it that iconic moment of cinema because of the influence of 51st Dates. But
51st Dates is such a trope-filled film. It's stealing tropes from movies that haven't even come out yet.
Like that, and I'm like, the thing, I'm like, oh my God, like, good for Adam Sandler. Because the initial thought when I see that sequence is Adam Sandler is this fan of cinema, and good for him for, like, so quickly being able to ape what happened in The Notebook, right? And then when I see it, but The Notebook hadn't come out yet, Devin, I'm like, oh, damn.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I don't know, it's so cool. It's too cool for me to, like, look at this film and be like, this film is the first adaptation of The Notebook in a lot of really weird ways.
Yeah, man. I applaud that observation because I never would have seen that.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever actually seen The Notebook film. Now that I'm thinking about it, I've read the book a bunch of times, but I don't think I've ever seen the movie.
Oh man, the movie is like I'm like not even joking. Like the movie is like must see cinema for me. Like I don't know.
I think that's why the admission is the fact that, like, you as someone, like, it's must see cinema. You don't think of it in terms of this, and yet I as because the book is in my car right now. Right, I don't go anywhere without The Notebook because I told someone I would let them borrow it. And then I never got to give it to them. So, like, in that right, off George. Chance that I run into them, I can be like, oh, by the way, here's The Notebook for you to read. It's been in my car since the Saturn, since the car that you and I passed 100,000 miles in. So it's like a weird thing that, like, is going to be connected to this movie for me on other levels. So I don't know. But yeah, that's a lot I'm borrowed, and I'm sorry. I couldn't believe that it's The Notebook, that this film is The Notebook, right down to the fact that there's a README file in real life at a moment in this film. But let's get to Blue, right? Let's get to Blue. Let's get to the part where you break my heart, because I was humble and innocent in my Blue, and then you show me the deepest, dankest parts of humanity.
Well, yeah, so there's quite a bit in this movie actually that definitely qualifies as blue humor. It's one of those things where I think that this is also in a lot of ways it kind of speaks to what I was saying, where Sandler really starts to feel comfortable again, just kind of doing his own thing after a few years of recovering from the blow that was Little Nicky. And so in that, he returns to a lot of really old style comedy that we would have seen more in Billy Madison than recent years, right? One of those things is like the low key transphobia that happens in a few moments in this movie, not just one, a few. Some of the stuff we've already talked about with the way that mental health is handled in this movie could probably be considered that. But I mean, like, I'd be foolish to not point out one of the most obvious ones here, and that has to be Ula, played by Rob Schneider, and specifically the ways in which that shows how some of the Pacific Islander stuff in this film is then addressed. It's a really weird conversation, because on the one hand, you have this sore thumb sticking out the entire time in that your third build, your third lead in this movie is Rob Schneider playing this character. And there's some discussion to be had about the fact that he is Filipino, so there is some conversation there about the idea of, like, well, you know, people just assume that he's white, so he doesn't get to play these kinds of roles. But Filipino does not mean, like, Pacific Islander. Like, you don't get to that. That's not part of that realm. That's a different thing, right? It's the same thing, like, when we see somebody who is, like, you know, they're I was going to say Mandarin, and that's not a real thing. But maybe, you know, they're Chinese and they're speaking one dialect, and it's assumed that everyone in that area of the world must understand it. And we're learning more and more in Western cultures that that's not how that works, right? We can't just assume that they're all one people, right? And that's to this point that putting Schneider in this role is still problematic, no matter how you kind of cut this. To that same point, Amy Hill, I believe is her name, who yep. plays Sue, a phenomenal actress, and again, like, she's the thing is that she's Japanese, and even beyond that, she's American born, from what I understand. So, like, there's there's just something there too that's just really problematic. Now, that being said, we then do get the guy that is the chef, that he isn't really given much more of a character though. And I'm gonna butcher his
Nick
name,
or
but
Tattoo
it's
Face.
yeah,
But yeah.
but it's Pomihikai Brown, and I hope I said that right. It's Pomihikai Brown
Yep.
is his name, and he is actually Hawaiian, and there and a lot of the extras in the movie are actually Hawaiian peoples, or at least people that are from that area. So like there's this weird like double move that this movie makes, where on the one hand it really does celebrate this area, and there is a lot of talk about I mean there is a lot of off-screen talk about like who is on screen and who isn't in terms of like in the background and stuff like that. But then like your main dude that is going to represent these people is then this fucking joke of a character played by Rob Schneider the whole time, who is just a fucking idiot and smokes weed all day. And so like it just it's too much. Like it and I have to point that out as like that's just too blue. And it doesn't hold up now. And at the time I don't think it was cool. Like it's not one of those things that everybody was like at the time, like, oh man, it's great that we're at least we've got a character that's on screen. No, this doesn't fall into that conversation for me.
No, not at all. Especially like, and it's not even one of those moments where like, oh, he's allowed to do that because look of all this other representation that they went out of their way to get. Like, honestly, this discussion is going to send me down a path looking into Amy Hill, because I love Amy Hill. She is, I love her as an actor. I love what she, that episode of Seinfeld where she's Frank Costanza's lost love is very funny. But the more prominent reason where I want to know more about Amy Hill is that she is currently on Magnum PI playing a, she's a native Hawaiianer, and her character does a lot to advocate for the like history and preservation of the island's history.
Well, and there
So,
is a lot of crossover
yeah.
between the Hawaiian people and that and Japan and all of that. Like there is a large population. So it's not that somebody that is of that descent can't be from Hawaii.
Right.
It's just that idea that like that is not what we're led to believe in this movie. We are led to believe that the people that he interacts with are supposed to be these Native Hawaiians. Like what's the proper term here? I don't know if Pacific Islanders or Samoans or what it is that we're supposed to say here, because the movie never te the
The
movie has
movie
this
never takes the
opportunity here,
time, yeah.
and it never teaches me like it, and so like
Yeah. I mean,
I
yeah.
am now left sounding like an idiot here, right?
Right. I mean, I guess the reason why I want to look into that is just seeing Amy Hill in the role, informed by the role that she's been playing in Magnum, I immediately thought, oh, so she must be a native Hawaiianer, and like, good for them for doing it. So you just kind of shatter that whole perception for me. So, like, to the point where I want to inform myself more about where she comes from as an actor. Because that's interesting to me. Because, like, I gave her immediate cred because of what she's doing in modern times for being in this film. And especially with just how many, like, Native Hawaiian peoples are represented in the Hukilau scenes. Like,
I
it's
don't, you know, and I
impressive.
don't,
Like,
yeah, and I don't know too much about like your background. I know that
right.
she grew up in South Dakota, or at least was born there. She at some point went to acting school in like New York, I want to say, like the big city. Like it might have been LA, so maybe so like it could easily be that I'm transposing something here that I shouldn't be. But from what I understand, that like she's brought in because she's a phenomenal actress that just happens to physically fit this perception that Sandler and his company see for this role, and that's terrible.
So, I mean, I guess the reason why it's so interesting to me in terms of that representation is because it's sort of like the Apu question, where like because of Apu on The Simpsons being that iconic role of you know, someone from India in it, and that not being the case, but then it influencing Indian characters in Hollywood in perpetuity for 30 plus years because of that one gross ethnic stereotype portrayed by Hank Azaria.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's even more akin to something like the original West Side Story with Marita Moreno, right? And
Yeah.
that where she's playing this this at the time wonderful breakout character that has since brought up a lot of questions for a lot of people that are just like, is that a good portrayal though, and like, is that okay? And then a lot of people being like, well, you know, yeah, nowadays no, and now here we are sitting on the precipice of Steven Spielberg putting another version of it out, so let's see what happens there. But like so, and so I think it falls for me more towards that when you're speaking specifically about that character, like oh, like, you know, they put some thought into casting someone that they felt could do a good job elevating that role, and it would give some respect to what they were doing. They didn't succeed in it, and it's why she's not my Blue.
Right? No, it's like specifically Rob Schneider who is more of the stereotype, and kind
just beyond the stereotype. Yeah. Even worse, he's creating stereotypes.
He creates a stereotype.
A lot of what
he does. He's more the Apu in that thing. But then I guess what I'm thinking about is that lower level issue of it, where like when Magnum is searching for somebody to sort of be that mother to the team, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do they look for an Amy Hill type in 50 First Dates because she sort of acts as the mother to the patrons of that town and as a surrogate mother to Lucy?
Yeah.
Like wondering if the trope is made because of her portrayal in this, and then she's the one that they seek out to play a similar role in Magnum PI. It's just...
Yeah.
It's layers that I wasn't expecting. But you're not wrong. Ula and Rob Schneider doing that role is not as offensive as things that we're going to see later in things like I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry, or actually even a little bit earlier in something like Eight Crazy Nights.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, specifically in 2021.
I think Remember the Zohan also has some questions to answer for us someday, but
it's season 3 or beyond, who knows what we're going to consider the theme. But no, you've given me a lot to think about in terms of the Blue of this movie, because I mean the one thing that I focused on where I thought you were going to come from was that low-key transphobia in terms of the Alexa character.
Mm-hmm.
And that feeling on every level, trying to be them recapturing the magic of George from Wedding Singer.
Well, and again, they do that thing where you can tell that Sandler thinks that he's being a good guy because of the ways in which that character is treated in this film as just a friend that he can make jokes with. And like, and it's like watching your grandfather try and be on your side about a social issue. Like, you love him for trying, but you're just not getting it right. Like, the entire time. Like, you just, and so even that is like weirdly, like, not okay with me, but cushioned in a way that the Ula stuff never is, because he also just gives Ula a bunch of shit.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Ula's not even well treated in any way. Yeah.
Yeah, it's strange, but like I thought that's what you were gonna do. And then also that transphobic thing where like he thinks he's the good guy. It's your Jonathan Logren cameo is that he portrays someone who had gender reassignment surgery to go from Jennifer to Jonathan. And
right.
Like the
missing the entire point that if somebody that did present as female decided that they wanted to go through their life presenting as male, they wouldn't then act effeminate the rest of their lives.
Yeah,
it's
really like
weird. It's a really weird like yeah, it's such a bizarre moment. Not that like, but the other thing is, it's not that there's not like one person out there that could be like that. It's just like a weird choice for 2 seconds in your fucking comedy movie to try and address that. Like, why are we doing that, guys?
Yeah, it's, I don't know. Those are the things that stuck out. I mean, and for my Blue, I'll rip it off. It's Ula's milky left eye. Right? It's the most beautiful blue I've ever seen.
So much blue in this movie, and that's what you got.
Well, the problem is there's so much blue in this movie, and I'm ready to kick it into the discussion, because I want to start here.
Believe it or not, man, that's his good eye.
Yeah, I know, right? Ula's good eye is what I wrote down.
That's another really problematic thing with Ula, is there's actually some funny shit that happens with him that is marred completely by the stupid accent and the attitude and all of that. Like, there are some comments and some conversations that are legitimately great conversations. The entire joke about how he is just a failure and his kids are all amazing, and he clearly loves his children.
Yeah.
He takes them everywhere and takes care of them.
hate you kids. You're all so much better at everything than me. And like, exactly. And he says it with such pride, even in that term of like, yeah, it's a moment. It's a moment that exists in the film. He is an interesting character, and it sucks that he is just so much a walking, talking, problematic stereotype.
Yeah.
That woof, just woof. But no, there is so much blue in this movie, but it's the same reason that there was so much blue in Just Go With It. And that's the fact that Adam Sandler is playing a doctor. Now, granted, he's playing an animal doctor, but, and this is how the day started. The day started with me going on Google and seeing how much an aquarium veterinarian makes. And at the low end, it's $64,000 a year. At the high end, like the top 10% are making $116,000 a year. So like, there's a good chance that this character, Henry Roth, is probably making around $100,000 a year as a salary. Because in addition to the fact that he is a veterinarian, like he has a skill that he is trained to work in. He's also on Hawaii, where, like, the cost of living is higher, and that is reflected in especially in 2004, not so much now, but that's not what this podcast is about. The cost of living is so high, so salaries reflect that.
Yeah, and then there's a couple of other things to consider here. Not only is he a vet, but he is a specialty vet, because he's not just dealing with dogs and cats and people's pets, right? He's dealing with penguins and walruses and seals. So, like, he is a specialty vet on top of that. Yeah. He hints at the idea that he is actually there for reformation, so, like, to get the animals better, to go back to the wild. So he's also not just, like, a SeaWorld veterinarian working for whatever they pay him. He is actually, like, a conservationist in some way. He lives at the aquarium. We see that it is his bed that they are like sitting on when he's talking to Ula in that first scene. So like, he's not living anywhere. The one thing that he puts any money into is this boat, and as we can clearly see, he has not put much money into it. He's doing a lot of the work himself piece by piece, and it's still falling apart all the time. So like, there's a lot hinting at the fact that he probably makes a lot of money and he doesn't spend much of that money. So when it comes to things like doing a first date every day with this woman and taking her places and stuff like that, there's never a question in your head of where the money's coming from. There's never a moment where you wonder that. And it's not like at the end the boat has become some miraculous like cruise ship.
It's not a yacht, yeah.
Right. So like, the what's really funny is that as much as this movie seems to inform Just Go With It in terms of like what they wanted to do, like just I not to be too crude, but just replace Drew Barrymore. Wow, I got even worse than I thought. But replace Drew Barrymore with Jennifer Aniston. But like, there's this idea that like this time around they seem to pay attention to some of the realism of the character and the story in a way that would just go with it. That just all went out the window because they just really just wanted to just spend some dosh and just spend some time in fancy places. So like, there's this weird thing that they've learned all the wrong lessons from this movie and then took that and they just go with it.
Right. But the thing that they did learn that I don't want to give them credit for, but it's that if we put him in blue shirts, he'll still present as a blue-collar everyman.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why there's so much blue in this movie. And it's the reason why I'm wearing a blue shirt right now. So that I'll feel relatable to myself.
Yeah, but I think that, again, the wrong lessons are learned. They thought that was the reason why we all considered him lovable and relatable in this movie, so that's what they did in that one, when that's not what it is. What it is the fact that, yes, he's working this high-paying job, but we also see him suffering in a lot of ways. And I don't mean suffering as in, like, boo-hoo, wah-wah, but he's not living in a fancy house. He's not out every night in Hawaii spending money on ridiculous things. He's going out to bars and stuff to meet women, but we never see him, like, wow them by, again, taking them onto, like, fancy yachts or anything like that. He doesn't pretend to be richer than he is.
He's
like,
going
in fact,
out every night with women to bars and buying them non-alcoholic drinks.
Exactly. I was gonna say, in fact, quite the opposite. The reason that he's able to eventually be with these women is not because he's tricking them or lying to them, which he is doing, but that's not the reason that he ends up with them. The reason that he ends up with them is because they are looking for a holiday fling. And he knows that. So he knows that he can be basically himself, not spend any real money, not even get them drunk, and they're still going to end up with him. And then the next day, yes, he does this horrible thing where he makes up a lie and runs away. But that is like, that is the worst he does compared to what we see later in things like Just Go With It, where he's much terrible. And it's also hugely addressed in this film. It becomes plot significant that the first person he can't seem to do that with is this one woman where he could get away with it. He instantly realizes that that is not the right thing to do here. And he instantly starts to question himself and what he has been doing because of the instance. And we hear that conversation that you and I, like we hinted at earlier at the beginning of the show with our recording, but there's moments before that are like super significant to the fact that like he recognizes that taking advantage of this woman with this mental disability, for lack of a better term, like would be straight up evil. His words.
Yeah.
Like, so again, just learned all the wrong lessons from this movie. They just thought it was because he was wearing a blue shirt and everything around him was blue. We just assumed he was an everyman, not the fact that he is actually kind of a nice guy in this movie.
Yeah. They're like, oh, if we put him in blue, he can do whatever he wants. No, that's not necessarily true. Right. I like your enthusiasm. Not necessarily the case, though.
The other thing that I cannot believe is that with the just while we're in this realm of the Just Go With It comparison, our big issue with that movie was that there were things in that movie that they just decided to just not show us, right? Famously, the end of that film, they don't show us the breakup scene. I cannot believe how intense the car crash scene was in this movie. For talking about that movie not showing us anything, this movie has this horrific moment in it where there's this car crash that I was affected by watching today.
Yeah. I mean, do cows dart, though? Do cows dart?
Well, no, but we're given the impression that her father is not paying attention, yeah, right? And yeah, which, exactly. which in and of itself has so much connotation to a lot of what happens later on in this film. But the idea being that, like, that this was just an accident, just a horrific accident, and they show it to you, and they hardcore show it to you. That pineapple goes rolling across the floor, and I almost lost my shit. I almost started bawling my eyes out.
I did. No, that's not true. The first two times I watched this movie, this is the rare Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe film where I watched it three times. I watched it twice today. I'm not going to lie to you. I just had nothing going on for at 4 o'clock, and I'm like, I'm gonna watch 50 First Dates again, and yeah. Like, I'm glad that I did, because it was sort of my sober viewing of it. Not that I was under the influence of anything, but like that first time I just kind of got caught up in the magic of this movie. And then the second time with a notebook, I'm like, oh wow, I misinterpreted a lot of this, but it still hit me on that emotional level. And yeah. Then that third time, it was like the clinical viewing. Like, I am a robot. I have no emotions. Let's take this one in. And that scene every time is hard to handle.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Like, so,
but that's why the fact that you see the byline of the car crash, article so many times. And it says Marlon Whitmore was in a car accident when a cow darted out in front of him. And it's yeah, just like, yeah. Cows don't dart. Cows do a lot of things, but they do not dart.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've only really got a few more things that we really haven't touched on. Is there mm-hmm. anything else specifically with the Just Go With It stuff you want to touch on? Because I want to start focusing on the movie itself.
Yeah, no, it really, the big one was the fact that he's a doctor in this. He's a doctor in that. So let's put him in blue in both, and it works in one, it doesn't work in the other, because you have to consider the character of it all. I guess the other thing is the German accent.
Yep.
Of it.
Yeah, the weird accent stuff in both of them.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought we were gonna at least mention the big thing is the lying to women part of it. Right?
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, there is that aspect of it. But you know what's so strange about that? And I think this is a solid transition into a bigger discussion specifically about 50 First Dates is the whole opening montage where all of these women are relating their beautiful vacation romances with Henry James. Roth and Kevin James, which, yeah, we'll peel that Band-Aid off as soon as I finish this thought, is that feels like a different movie. That feels like that is the most Adam Sandler that this film feels. Right up until Jocko the Walrus, and that's his character name. I don't remember the name of the actual animal that played that role, throws up on Alexa. That feels so much like this is Adam Sandler and Alan Covert coming in with their type of humor and the way that they want to start a movie. But as soon as he goes, star date November 5th, 6:47 a.m. on the Sea Serpent, it feels like, and now here's the movie proper. Mm-hmm. It is such a tonal shift. Like, yeah. I don't believe that he is the character who has been able to entertain, I feel like it's like 10 different women and Kevin James in that opening montage that are telling the stories of this lover.
I know.
Like,
I know. And the wrong lesson learned yet again. People, that is still, like, because it's the most Adam Sandler-y part, that is the part that a lot of people, like, I remember, like, quoting and things like that, especially like referencing the Kevin James twist and things like that, or the vomiting of the walrus being a moment that was often, like, replayed and laughed at with my friends at parties. Like, so that being the thing that a lot of people latched onto, we then see with Just Go With It, the idea that is then blown up to the first hour of that movie, which, as we noted, suddenly turns into a different film, right?
Mm-hmm. It suddenly turns into the remake that it is. Let's give people the Adam Sandler that they want, and then let's sneak in a movie on the tail end of this. It's strange. It is so strange. It's so strange to the fact that, like, even now talking about it, like, that's not the interesting stuff that I feel needs to be examined, because it feels weird. Like, sorry, continue.
No, there's a lot of weird movies from that time period, now that I'm thinking about, that kind of do that, like the weird misogynistic date montage. And like, I don't mean that the date montage is adjective misogynistic, although I guess you could say that too. What I mean is that it is misogynistic hyphen date montage, where, like, I'm thinking of Wedding Crashers.
Yep,
I'm thinking
exactly
of Good Luck Chuck. I'm thinking of there's a whole bunch of those where like those movies that kind of really they wanted you to know, like, this guy's a womanizer and a bad dude, so that when we roll into this story, you don't know whether or not you're supposed to like him. But then, like, instantly they were given, like, this charm that we're supposed to, like, that's supposed to turn us around, right? Like, that's the play. And this movie, it is such a hard, it's such a hard left that it's a bigger car crash than the one actually in the movie.
Boom! You've been sitting on that one. And perfect delivery, Seijin. Two thumbs up. Yeah, it is. It feels so strange. I mean, even down to the fact that, like, when he tries to deny it by going out with Missy Pyle, shout out Missy Pyle in this film, in a beautiful little moment. Like, even then I'm like, I don't think that you would have actually slept with this woman, outside of the fact that she straight up says, despite everything that you're presenting, I still want to have sex with you. Like, yeah. Like, it really is just, man. Like, I don't know. It erases so much of, like, what is meant as character development in that opening, like, 20 minutes of the movie. That then it goes away.
It's unnecessary, right? Yeah. It's not even, it's so unnecessary, because you're right. Like, it becomes so weird. It feels like a different movie, to the point where I'm not remembering that that's what he was like before. All I need to know about this dude is that he is trying to get off of the island. He is less than, like, a day away from it happening at any moment. And that he is suddenly in this position where he meets a woman that he's like, oh no, I don't know if I can leave now because of this thing. Like, that's all I need to know for his part of the story to work. I don't need him to be gross. I don't need him to be a womanizer that learns a lesson. That's just not what I need. That's kind of what I mean by the misogynistic hyphen date montage. Like, the necessity of that to be placed into these movies just to show us, just to get that rise out of us, is just so weirdly unneeded.
Yeah.
in most of these movies, never mind this one.
It really feels like a product of the time. I mean, the one that I sort of compared it to, and for no other reason than the fact that it's just a movie I think about, was Old School.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that, like, this whole opening feels like Old School, but, like, dumbed down into a 15-minute montage.
Yeah.
Of just, like, man-child antics. Because Ula, for all of the whatever Ula is Vince Vaughn saying he wants to live vicariously through Luke Wilson's exploits. Like, it's weird. I'm just like, oh my God, it's like, oh, we need to do the old school comedy or this isn't going to work. This film's not going to have universal appeal if we don't do what is happening in comedy right now.
Yeah, that is such a prevalent weird trope in the comedy of that time that I don't remember Van Wilder having that montage, but I'd be surprised if it didn't. Like, that kind of, you start remembering movies of that ilk and you start thinking, well, it must have had it, even if I can't think of it, right?
Yeah. I mean, he just kind of has like a cool guy montage and why he'd be the one that everybody wants to be like. I haven't watched that movie in a while, and that's a discussion for another time, but yeah, it's one. But as soon as Lucy comes into it, I mean, the only real reference that exists at all is that when he tries the exact same tactic with her of putting a toothpick into her little Waffle House, and it just fallen flat on its face. Yeah. When he tries to go through the exact motions of getting this girl to fall in love with him a second time.
Well, and that's actually a really beautiful moment because it shows you, the audience, that he can't just perfect a formula and trick this woman, right? Like, he needs to actually be sincere in the moment. Yeah. And so the first time he did it, he was extremely sincere, but that time, no go, because he was just trying the same thing. It's a lot in that moment that's actually really beautiful, and I still think I didn't need that montage in the beginning to get that.
No, I think that if you just see it that first time where, like, this girl is in my mind, this girl that I saw across a diner, right, mm-hmm. yesterday, like, I'm going back to that diner because I want to see if I can meet her. So then he does it, and it's sincere, but then if he goes back the next day and he's like, all I gotta do is put a toothpick in her little waffle sculpture, and I'm in like Flint, and then that not working... Like, it's enough character development. It's enough character development because it's the first actual character development we get for Henry Roth. Because everything that came before it really doesn't matter.
Right.
Yeah. I wanna. We talked a lot about new, and our news were important, right? The first Kevin James is important, and it is worth mentioning. And the fact that this is the first vacation slut destination filmmaking Adam Sandler film, those are big moments. But like, I want to give a shout out to the fact that this is Sean Astin showing up in these films for the first time. Mm-hmm. This is where they make it, and it's also a Sean Astin who has just been Samwise Gamgee's for three movies.
Including that year, and like, it's still in theaters in Return of the King, the one that would go on to win an Oscar.
Yeah, exactly. He is showing up in 51st Dates as Doug Whitmore, the roided up, tight-assed, like, weirdly lisping for some reason brother. Right? Like, yeah, like, you want to talk about another accent issue? I don't understand.
I do agree that it was definitely a choice for him to push that. Although I will point out that it's not the first time we've ever heard him with one. I actually just this weekend just rewatched The Goonies as part of the hollow watching that we're doing. And in that, his character, and at the time, I've always assumed that was just the way that he spoke when he was younger, and he just kind of grew out of it. But now I'm wondering if he put an accent on in that movie. He does have a little bit of a lisp in that film. So I'm wondering if it is more of like a hyper like representation of a speech impediment he might actually already have. But yeah, I don't know. They use it. They reference it very often. So like, part of me has to imagine that he can't really have that, or else how rude is that for them to turn it into a joke in the movie? But then how rude is it to turn it into a character thing if he doesn't actually have it? For sure, it was really weird. The note I actually have about it is Sandler films, and we've never really talked about this, but the reason that I think Sandler is able to get people into these movies to do these weird roles when they are people like Sean Astin or just a year earlier with Jack Nicholson and stuff like that is Sandler films are safe spaces. You know, like there are these places where people can come and play, and they're not, you know, it's no harm, no foul. Like, your career's not going to be over if you showed up in an Adam Sandler film and it goes nowhere. Look at Harvey Keitel showing up as the devil,
as the devil in Little Nicky,
right? Which might be considered like the worst of the Sandler films by some people. They don't hate Harvey Keitel because he was in that movie, like, but he got to show up and have some fucking fun on that set, right? With Blake Clark, but
which, yeah. Also, shout out to Blake Clark. So many old stuff that he just doesn't get mentioned, and he does a lot of heavy lifting in this movie.
Is this his best role? This might be his best role in his career. Like I will always remember him as like Sean's dad, right? But him in this, but is the meat on the bones of this role is phenomenal. The ways in which he has to struggle with the fact that he was driving the car, the ways in which he has to be present for there. And there's that moment, the one moment that I always think of, is when Sandler says, you know, what happens in 10 years when she wakes up and she realizes how old she is, how much older you've gotten. And he's like, boy, I think about that every day. And it's just like punch in the heart, like, ow, like you think I don't think about this? He just, and like the fact that he's there at the end gets me, like, he has so many good moments in this movie. It's beautiful. It really is.
I mean, that I think about that every day is a 1-2 punch to the heart, because it's right before the like what happens on a day where the facade is broken for her. Where, like, she realizes that it's not October 13th, 2002, that time has passed, because that cop writes her a ticket. And I think that's my favorite goof or trivia about this movie, is that because she's in a private parking lot and not driving, she's actually not doing anything to warrant having a ticket written for her.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that's true. That's actually, that's a really good argument. Trivia.
I have definitely seen cops do it.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Right. But yeah.
But yeah. just saying, that ain't gonna stop a jerk. Are you talking about that moment when she drives home and he has that line that he screens out to Doug, where he's just like,
"It was a bad day." And the fact that all he has to say is "it was a bad day" implies that there have been other bad days. So
yeah.
Sorry. I just it
no, and the ways in which he is prepared for it,
so,
and then we see
much.
The montage. Yeah, it's and what that does really nicely is not only does it give that implication that, like, oh man, there's been some other terrible stuff, and geez, what were those days like? But it also covers a huge plot hole here, in that, like, there's not an assumption that Sandler's going to be the one to screw it up, right? Henry is not going to be the reason that she, that it's not, Henry is not something that's going to screw up their whole formula. Their formula has been screwed before and they've survived. They will survive Henry. And so that idea being that it really kind of lends credence to why he doesn't just kick Henry's ass out the door the second that he shows up, is because he's like, look, like I know you think you know what you're doing and you're wrong. And that is his attitude up until that moment when it's not. And and that's why I say I think this might be his best role
he's,
of his career.
It's all over it.
Because he carries that role so well.
But yeah, that... Oh, God, that just that moment that we had a bad day, and like that is just enough to like kick it. And the whole montage of them resetting the world for her, right? Mm-hmm. Them being the little trolls and gremlins that reset Groundhog Day for her is like, that's a heartbreaking and everything. And I really like it's one of those things where they kind of jeopardy it, where they give you the punchline and then you see the setup. And it's Sean Astin when he bets her who's going to do the dishes tonight.
Like,
you know, you've been doing this for so long, you're going to be tired of it on some level. And like that little bit of cynicism just leaking out into that moment it makes so much sense. But then also you see that, like, even though he feels like he's stuck because of the world that he has to inhabit for the good of his sister, he's right there being a part of it and participating and making sure that her life is as easy for her because of her condition as possible.
I mean, the fact that they both go with her and Henry to the facility, to the home, like, I mean, and have that relationship that they have with the doctor, where he shows up later and has a beer with the four of them, right? Like with the three of them. And but yeah, I mean, like, there's so much really good subtlety in the world building of this movie that, again, completely unlearned, and like in Sandler films going forward just goes out the window. Like, you just it's so unfortunate, because there's so much really good filmmaking in this movie. It's just marred in a lot of really goofy shit that understandably they decide that's where they're going to put their focus on in these future films.
Yeah. All right, so I've been looking at this stupid post-it note that I have on my screen, and this post-it note represents the dumbest math that I have ever done for anything that I've ever been involved in, and that is how many days this whole facade has been going on before Henry meets Lucy.
Okay.
And it's 295 days. And the way that I got there is that she was in the hospital for 3 months after the accident that occurred on October 13th, 2022. So then with 3 months, I gave a little leeway. I figured she woke up, or at least was home, on January 15th. And then it's 294 days to November 5th, a day that, you know, it's ironic because remember the 5th of November. But then he doesn't introduce himself until November 6th. So that's 295 days that Blake Clark and Sean Astin have had to watch The Sixth Sense as if it's the first time that they've seen it.
Oh, man. At the same football game and the same. Yeah. Man. Oh, man.
So when you actually like think about it, it adds a lot more credence to the fact that, I mean, he's only known her for roughly 15 days.
Yeah.
When they go out to the Institute, when she has that bad day, because we see at least 5 attempts to see her outside of the cafe and 5 dates at the cafe. And we're also told that there are some days that pass in between those.
Right.
But she goes back to the Institute on her own on November 25th to discuss the possibilities of what to do as a result of it, and she has to have seen the video that he makes for her prior to the 25th of November, because it's not until she sees that video that she starts journaling. So right. Like, this is not a lot of time that these people are spending together and in their lives. But then what was very interesting to me is how long is this going on, right? How long have these people been like sort of stuck in this day, all for the well-being of this one person? And like, to think of it as 295 days, like that hit yeah. a lot harder for me.
Yeah, man. Time is meaningless in this film, though, because at the end of this movie they somehow have like a 5-year-old child, and I have no idea what I'm supposed to understand. Is that supposed to be the future at that point? Like, what is, like,
yeah, they have a 5-year-old child, Siege, and it's the future.
No, but like so there's a lot that we suddenly skip. Like, we see them finally get back together, and then literally there's a small child running around that he's like, here's your daughter. And it's just like, whoa, credits roll. Okay. Like, so like at that point, I don't think about the rest of the time in this movie, because that's the thing I'm focused on.
Way that you feel, and that might be the crowning achievement of this movie, that is literally full of kind of crowning achievements, I'm just going to say it, is the fact that in the end, you kind of get an idea of how this woman feels every day.
Yeah.
Because it just smash cuts from them kissing at the Callahan Institute to her waking up in Alaska and finding out that she's got a child who the youngest she could be is 3. There's no way she's any younger than 3 years old. The way that she is ambulatory and walking and speaking, the youngest that kid is 3 years old. But 5 really does feel more like the sweet spot.
Yeah.
And it's and you're kind of like just shaken up, like, and you watch that video and the video has not changed that much.
Yeah. No.
And the daughter is not mentioned in the video.
At least not from what we see of it. Yeah. Unless there's pieces of it we're not seeing. Yeah.
Like, ooh. And I know, man. That video defeats the whole purpose of the journal that she's supposed to read so that she feels like she's telling herself the story.
Kind of wondering why they didn't decide to reshoot the video with her being the one telling herself what was going on.
Yeah, that's a huge plot hole right there. Because it's like the video is smart because you don't have to read it as you wake up disoriented.
Mm-hmm.
And like on a boat for some
although it
reason.
Would really fuck with you if you started seeing a video of yourself you didn't remember recording, just saying.
I don't know, I've never seen Memento, or maybe I have and I've just forgotten, but it's one of those situations where, like, I mean, the written word, there why is there any more credence to that than actually looking at yourself and saying, hi, what's going on? I know you're going to be a little shaken up, but
The last thing that I have in my notes before we kind of do a little bit of our roundup judgment, is, and we had not talked about this nearly enough, is that Drew Barrymore, and I think because we focus so much about how amazing she was in The Wedding Singer, I can just tie onto that and say that she just elevates this movie. I mean, like, she has so much work she needs to do because she needs to display that same moment in so many different days of discovery, that moment of discovery when she realizes what's going on and has to deal with it, and the fact that she has to display it on days when it's good news, on days when it's bad news, in places where it's public, in places where it's private. Like, she just, the fact that she has to make the same like the same thought process in her head and deal with that but with different context 1,000 times in this movie. They call it 50 First Dates, but it sure felt like it was 100 more. Like and the fact that it works every time. And then on top of that, there are those moments when she has dealt with it and she's happy, and when she has dealt with it and she's still not happy. Like, there's just so much in this movie that she needs to do with such little context for the character. It's actually kind of amazing acting work, and she just knocks it out of the park. Like, this movie would not work if she was not believable in this role. And I don't just mean like, oh, it's believable that she forgot things, but like believable that she's also finding shit out, and she just rocks.
Yeah, it's not so much the fact that she plays so many different roles in this film. Like, there's the one where she beats up Ula and she gets to be, like, really aggressive. There's the time where he pretends that he can't read and then she just, like, lays into him with, like, you waste my fucking time all day and you don't even ask for my number. And the most impressive thing about every shade of Lucy Whitmore that she puts on display in 50 First Dates is all of them feel like it is the same person. It never bleeds into a belief that, like, it's a split personality or this is coming from nowhere in this moment. Everything feels like it has been built and informed up to October 13th, 2002, and comes from those experiences. And that the ability to do that, right, especially in a film that's like kind of like comedy skit in a lot of ways, right? Because, like, talking to Return to Form, it does. It feels like that, oh, here's a funny thing and we can do it. But no, like, she approaches it as the same character for every improv sequence that they throw her into.
Yeah, I mean, it makes moments like the breakup and the third act breakup have this... She is able to bring a gravitas to that moment that makes you feel sad that you've been watching these two people for the last hour and a half and they're going through this. But also at the same time, to her, it's just the one day. But you believe it. Like, there's never a moment where you question that, right? Like, she says to him, like, these things about how she's like, I can't be holding you down. Look at the ways that my family treats me, all of this stuff. To her, this is all new information. So she's still processing it, but her reasoning is still sound, and her ability to express it is still sound. So it she makes a lot of stuff in this movie that in other hands would not work. She makes it work, and that's, I mean, good for the movie. Like, yeah.
Right. And I think – we've talked about it before, especially with this whole thing that we've been exploring in the terms of the fact that in some of these films, they feel like two-handers, right? Like in the Jennifer Aniston films, clearly Adam and Jennifer are these fully realized characters.
Mm-hmm.
And even in The Wedding Singer, right? Like, it's Robbie's story, but that doesn't change the fact that Julia is a fully realized character with hopes and dreams and all of that.
Right.
And the weirdest thing about this film, right, is as much as she does some great character work to be the character of Lucy Whitmore, in a lot of ways, because of the nature of this film, she's sort of just a prop to his story. But then, thinking about it, he's also sort of this non-developed character. It is sort of the shallowest Adam Sandler character, definitely, that we've explored on this show.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, this is really the first one where we don't have some sort of grand origin for why. Like, why is he in Hawaii? We're never told why he's in Hawaii. We're just told that he wants to go to Alaska. But, like, I don't think this guy was born in Hawaii. I think he came to Hawaii eventually. But why is that? The biggest origin we're given is for his commitment issues. And that's because his college girlfriend, Tracy, cheated on him. But even then, like, that goes away when it is said that, like, at some point I'm going to leave for Alaska and I don't want anything in Hawaii to hold me back from going to do that.
Yeah.
Like, that is that's what he exists as. He exists as this person who knows eventually I have to leave the island.
Yeah, their relationship is more developed than them as people.
Yeah.
Right?
And that's brilliant. It's actually a brilliant way to like sort of safeguard Drew Barrymore just feeling like some prop to this guy's story by making both of them sort of just props to the actual story of the film.
To the larger story, yeah.
Yeah, it's
weird.
I don't know. I've been wrestling with that one, right?
Yeah.
Because, like, we want to celebrate these movies, and I guess we're into the judgment section of this, right? In, like, she's not... We don't want a woman who needs to be saved by Adam Sandler if it's going to be an Adam Sandler cinematic universe film. And even though he develops, like, some ways to deal with it, eventually it's her idea that, like, no, I'm going to write my own journal, right? Like, you got me to that point.
Yeah.
But I'm saving myself. Well, I'm going to recapture it. Yeah.
Right. And her life, despite the fact that there was a large issue within her life was not broken and needed saving from him. She was living her life. She was happy. And she has a support system. She has her family. She has the facility with a doctor. She has all of these people around her that would have still been helping her and still been there for her. Sandler is not coming in and saving the day in that sense, right? Much in the same way that we've talked about the idea that these other characters in these movies, we're eventually going to be talking about more than just women. It just so happens that everything we've talked about so far has just revolved around this, is the idea being that they do, though, in some ways, change Sandler, right? They change his character and affect him. And I think that is present in this movie, in that we see him as this, like, womanizer ready to run off, and then he becomes something else. But as we pointed out, that is really shallow. But it is there. It's present.
Yeah. I mean, if there's something about him that needs to be changed in this film, as we said, it's changed within the first 20 minutes of the film.
Yeah, he needs to learn how to commit, is, like, the thing that we're told about him. And then he learns that pretty instantly, because his commitment to this character, to Lucy, is beyond the pale. Like, he the ways in which he commits to this woman that he has suddenly found himself smitten with could be unhealthy in darker hands.
Yes. I mean, like, there's that moment where she calls him a stalker, and, like, yeah, kinda, right? Yep. Like, if you retained it, if this was, like, an actual growing relationship, it wouldn't feel that strange, but the fact that he is just like making sure he knows as much as he can about you to make you fall in love with him in a 24-hour period, like, yeah, there's a darkness there that is not fun to explore. So I'm going to steer my car away from that cow.
Yeah. What are some of the other rules we should look at?
I mean, I'm just going to rip the Band-Aid off on this one. I struggle to put this one in our Adam Sandler cinematic universe. I honestly struggle to put it in there.
I mean, I can give you my biggest reason why it probably doesn't work.
All right, I'd love to hear it. And that
there's no antagonist. There's no evil villain. There's no guy to join Eric.
Yeah, I agree that. I mean, that's a beautiful argument. For me, it is the fact that Adam Sandler has that sort of pithy remark about the Happy Gilmore swing. That's the stupidest swing I've ever seen. That like this film, in having that meta commentary about something that exists so firmly and staunchly in the ASCU, sort of puts it a level above it.
I think what this movie really truly does is it tricks a lot of Sandler fans in coming to see a romantic comedy that ends up not being a Sandler movie. And we talked about how there's this hard moment where suddenly it stops being Adam Sandler comedy and suddenly just becomes this romantic comedy. And it's that moment where suddenly it becomes a different movie. And if you're a Adam Sandler fan and you're just like, hey, there's this romantic movie coming out on Valentine's Day, so I can take my partner with me, so this is great, we're gonna go and see it, I get Adam Sandler, she gets a love story, everything is good, so this is Seijin at that time, and then we go, and then little Seijin never quite figured out that it wasn't actually an Adam Sandler movie the whole time. I think that what this movie does is it wears the veneer of being a Sandler universe film for like the first 10 minutes just to kind of get me in the movie, like the people like me in the movie, into the movie, and then it stops being that pretty quickly. So, like, if it had continued down the path that the first 10 minutes of this movie were, we'd be having a very different conversation. But the fact that it takes that hard turn and becomes something else entirely, I think it kind of steers away from being part of the universe.
Right. And if it were in the universe, right, which I think we're both agreeing that it's not, right? But even if it were, it would be such a high peak in terms of the films that are in that universe that it would almost feel like an outlier even within the universe, right? Like it's in there, but it does this better, or it has an idea about this. And what it really does, what is impressive, right, is that first 10 minutes really does like say, oh yeah, this is an Adam Sandler movie. I made the right decision, right? I'm not getting fucking Punch Drunk Love, right? I avoided that pitfall again, right? And it's not Little Nicky, right? It's not just a greatest hits movie. Like, this is old school Adam Sandler, and I am on board for that. And then, even though it takes that turn and all of that, anytime where you might like drift to that realization that like this isn't an Adam Sandler movie, it doles out like that little bit of Adam Sandler cinematic universe goodness to like keep you happy. Like
Rob Schneider sticking a joint in his ass. Yeah, exactly. Referencing Happy Gilmore.
The Happy Gilmore reference is just like for me, who's watching the film trying to determine, is this part of an Adam Sandler cinematic universe, an overall connected shared universe? That happens, and I'm like, oh no, no.
Me wondering if the penguin is invisible this entire
time. Yeah, right? Like, the penguin, exactly. Like, those moments. The Tommy Boy of it all, right? Alan Covert showing up and being just hilarious as 10-second Tommy. And Peter Dante and John Logren and Blake Clark and the references to nipples and like how that relates to both of Blake Clark's characters have seen before, Farmer Fran and the head demon, right? I think that's his name in that film.
Yeah.
Like it's like these moments where like, oh yeah, Adam Sandler. I love Adam Sandler movies.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah.
And then Adam Sandler sings a song to Drew Barrymore, which we haven't talked about yet. But then, like, also, oh, yeah, right? Like, he did that in The Wedding Singer. I love Adam Sandler movies. And it's, like, it's this slow, steady drip to keep you engaged on that level that they sold pretty much everybody who went to go see this movie on, while silently feeding you vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of like an actual factual movie,
they told me I was going to see Big Daddy, and instead they gave me The Notebook. Like, that's what they did. That's what I mean.
I mean, yeah, that's yeah. Well, they told me I was getting The Wedding Singer, and what they gave me was The Notebook.
There you go.
Is the thing good? Oh, Seijin, I got to be honest with you, dreading this moment in the episode for fear that we might not align on that. And even when you're like, to spark the fuel of the fire, I'm like, you could just be talking about stuff like the Ula character. But yeah. And then like the other, and the final like nail in the coffin is that the only other movie that we have staunchly said does not fit in our, you know, star chart of an Adam Sandler cinematic universe is Just Go With It.
Mm-hmm.
And that film is so informed by this film.
Mm-hmm.
That, like, it pulls it out of any sort of universal orbit to share an orbit with Just Go With It.
Yeah. No, I love this movie, and I encourage anyone that has enjoyed the Adam Sandler films that we have talked about, like, to watch it, because it is there. The DNA is present. It's just, at this point, it's so far removed that we're talking about, like, multiverses at this point, right? Like, it's not part of the universe that we've been creating.
Right. I mean, the exact thing that I hypothesized when we started this is that perhaps the Drew Barrymore trilogy will exist in a parallel universe. And mm-hmm. again, like, I will reveal, I haven't seen 50 First Dates since I first saw it in 2004.
Right.
This is the first time that I rewatched this movie, just like I did for The Wedding Singer. And where I was not even like pleasantly surprised, but like overwhelmingly like surprised by the fact that The Wedding Singer exists in a shared Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
Mm-hmm.
That is the same way that I felt about this film.
Yeah.
Because I thought that, like, because of The Wedding Singer and how big that feels, that obviously this one is going to slot in nicely. And then watching it, like, at every turn, I'm like, no, it's really not. If anything, it fits into a Peter Seagal cinematic universe that yeah, I'm, yeah. like, excited to maybe someday explore as, like, a side project. Because, like, Dan Aykroyd, my fellow Americans... And Tommy Boy, of course he's going to show up in 50 First Dates, right? Like, almost to the fact that...
Is he also in Grudge Match?
But, like, almost to the fact where I'm like, is Dan Aykroyd in this movie because of Adam Sandler, as I've always thought? Or is Dan Aykroyd in this movie because of Peter Seagal?
And then makes the relationship with Sandler, which is why he then shows up
Now Chuck and Larry, and in Pixels, and all of the other films that he shows up in. Like, it was that real moment where I'm like, this is more of a Peter Seagal, like, auteur oeuvre film than it is an Adam Sandler film.
Yeah.
And that was...
Yeah, I can definitely agree with that.
Yeah. And that's, I don't know. I mean, that's not for this, but it might be a fun little side project on the Say Report, where we can actually dive into Peter Seagal without... offending the listener who came here for all of the Adam Sandler goodness. But I think there's an important thing that a film like 50 First Dates not being part of our Adam Sandler cinematic universe leads to, right? And clearly it's not a law because we're saying it's not in there. But one of those big discussion points at the time of Hubie Halloween was, does this mean Uncut Gems is part of the shared universe?
Right.
And we're not going to pass that judgment now, even though I'm pretty sure we both went on record in our very first episode saying probably not, right? It's probably not. But it's layers and it's levels, and it's more than just having Adam Sandler in your film that mm-hmm. creates this shared universe.
Yeah, and it's more than having Sandler style comedy in your film, right? Like we aren't just writing movies off because they don't have the right comedic style. Because you could argue that a lot of what Just Go With It gets wrong is there's not enough Sandler in it. But if you listen to our episode, that's not our only complaint, right? And the same goes here. It's not that there's not enough Sandler in it. It's that there's this other stuff that should be present that just isn't sometimes. And the other thing I want to point out is that we didn't like Just Go With It. That's also not a qualifier. You don't have to be a movie we like in order to fit into the Sandler universe. Hell, go listen to some of those episodes about the Sandler universe, the ones we did include. We didn't love all of them either. But just because we really, or at least I will say I really like 50 First Dates as it stands, despite its flaws, it doesn't automatically slot it into the universe for me.
Oh yeah. Know? I love this movie. This is the first movie of this entire like look at these Adam Sandler films that like I'm excited I got to rewatch and I got to reevaluate. Like as much as watching The Wedding Singer and like being reminded of why that film is that film in our universe, and like Little Nicky and realizing, oh wow, that was formative for me, like it inspired a lot of who I am. Rewatching this movie, and as a movie that like I saw it and I liked it enough, but it wasn't one of those movies that I could watch over and over again, I've already watched it 3 times, and even as Robot Devin without emotions coming into it, immensely enjoyed my time with it.
Yeah.
And right now, I am telling Dale that she needs to watch The Sixth Sense in the next few days so we can watch 50 First Dates.
Just so she can get the joke.
Because I don't want 50 First Dates to spoil The Sixth Sense for her.
Fair enough.
Like,
fair
so it's enough. Like, I know you keep saying you want to see The Sixth Sense and Mom wants to watch it. You have a day off hanging out with Mom. Watch The Sixth Sense because we're going to watch 50 First Dates. And I'm not going to let that be the movie that spoils The Sixth Sense for you. You're not going to go however many years that you've lived on this planet and somehow don't know what The Sixth Sense is about and then have it ruined because of what is a one-off kind of hilarious moment in 50 First Dates. I just can't let that happen. That's just me. All right. So anything else before we move on? From this one,
just one last little tidbit of trivia.
This was
one of the first movies that I ever owned on Blu-ray, and I like in the back of my head, I always just was like, yeah, because you enjoyed it, and so you bought it. No, the reason that it was one of the first movies I ever owned on Blu-ray is because it was literally one of the first movies ever put out on Blu-ray. So I did not realize how quick to the trend I was on that one.
That's great. I'm so happy you get to share that story. Oh, that I love it. And I was really surprised to be like, wow, think about that. 50 First Dates, one of the first Blu-rays. Plus, like, it won a Kids' Choice Award. I was joking about that and the Nickelodeon Kids' Choice Award. I'm sure somebody involved in this movie got slimed.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore have spoken many times about their love of working together, and this is not the last time we're going to talk about them, so like we'll save more of it for later, but it just shows, and we said it with Wedding Singer, we'll say it here, like they have really good on-screen chemistry. It's just fun to watch them work together.
Yeah, that is 100% true. And just here's your homework, not that we give you homework. Next month it's Blended. We're going to finish off the trilogy. We've already mentioned it before, but if you are preparing before you listen to these episodes, the next one to watch is Blended. And I got to tell you, Blended is one of the movies that may have saved cinema for me. Not to give too much foreshadowing, but
bum, bum, bum.
Blended is a movie that was important for Devin Decker.
Sweet. I'm so excited. I don't think ever seen it.
Ooh, that's
it's one of those movies that I think I might have watched on like a plane. So like I'm gonna watch it and be like, oh right, I remember this now. But right now I couldn't tell you fuck all about that movie.
On a plane going to Africa, perhaps? I watched it at the Dirt Theater. I saw it at the Dirt Theater, and this might be one of the movies that saved my life. If I want to get like really hyperbolic about it, but that is a story for another time. So. If you've enjoyed what you've heard here at the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast, I will reiterate that Sejin and I also do a weekly podcast called The Say Report. And that one is not as hyper-focused on a topic as this one. That's a show that's literally about everything. In fact, this past week, we got wicked political. I don't think we could get political on the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. I think it'll happen maybe.
We did talk about pixels for a bit, and we did have to talk about government response. I know what you mean.
Yeah, like this is... So if you like us talking about the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe... But you maybe want to broaden the spectrum of topics available to us to discuss. It's recommended that you check out the Say Report. I think you'll enjoy it. Like I said, this is the second season. Go listen to the first season of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, where we established the rules and those films. You know what? It's October, right? So it's the perfect time to go back and listen to our sixth episode, Hubie Halloween, right? And I guess... You can weigh in. You can contact us. Contact me directly. I don't think Sejin cares. I know what Sejin's going to do. But I'm at Devin D. Decker. And you can tell me if, because I do an Adam Sandler podcast, it's like required for me to watch Hubie Halloween again this year during October. Because, like, I feel like maybe I'm good. But then there's another part of me that's like, hey, asshole, you do an Adam Sandler podcast. You're not getting away from your responsibilities.
Dedicate myself to one Halloween-based Adam Sandler movie a year, and it does not necessarily have to be Hubie. We will talk about other ones eventually.
That's exciting. I'm very excited. And in fact, there are people in this very house who are like, I kind of want to watch this movie. I've never seen it. And that one legitimate tingles up my spine. A film that I saw for the very first time 6 years ago. So, like, listen to the Say Report. I'm sure we'll be talking about that one. But this is the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. We are available on Twitter at the ASCU, and you can contact us on Gmail at the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe at gmail.com, because we thought, let's make it as long as possible, because that's funny. It's what Adam Sandler would do, right?
That's what Adam Sandler would do.
I don't know. Anything that you'd like to add, Sejin?
No, just enjoy yourselves and be safe this year. Halloween's going to get weird because this is maybe the first Halloween back, ? Everybody just be safe this month, and we'll see you next month.
Yeah, exactly. So, again, thank you for joining us on this exploration into the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. We will see you again next month. And until then, just remember, we have no idea what we're doing. Have a good one, folks. Thank you so much for listening to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe so it's delivered straight to you. And why not write or review? If you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, we're at the ASCU. And you can always send an electronic mail to Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe at gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Apologize to your mother for me, and we'll see you next time.